We're back on record. It's 2:33 on May 18th, 2010, with the continuation of the interview of Ms. Yoshizawa of Moody's Corporation. At the break, we were talking about notching of deals and the RMBS and the decision that was announced on September 21st, 2007, to notch Moody's own RMBS. How significant to the market was that announcement on September 21st for Moody's to say that they were notching the RMBS going into the CDOs? What was the significance of that?
It was the first time that we had done something of the sort where we were taking our own ratings and basically saying we're expecting there to be rating action, and therefore we are going to take our best information that we know in the CDO group from what we've been told by the RMBS, our RMBS counterparts, and apply a stress. Now, we have applied stresses in the past. That's not new. The way in which we did it was somewhat new. And so, as I said, a lot of the discussion leading up to that was not whether we should stress or not. It was about what is the best way in which to do it, what information should we use, so should we notch the rating, should we just apply a multiple to the assumptions of default and recovery, what's the best way in which to get across to the market what our thinking is. And this was kind of the way in which we thought about it. We talked to the RMBS group in terms of any information they can provide us in terms of differentiating the various categories. So I think we did it by vintage, maybe by the either current or original rating, can't remember. And basically we were just telling the market that we've already announced to you that we have and will continue to take some RMBS actions. We're not telling you what the specific actions will be, but we're telling you that for the CDOs that we're rating and that we're surveilling, that in order to take that into account, this is the way we're doing it. So, and this was, as I mentioned, this is significant because it was the first time that we had announced something like this.
First time you never notched your RMBS ratings for the underlying collateral for CDO?
In a sector. Yes.
Because you had previously notched ratings by other rating agencies of RMBS that were being put into CDOs, but this was the first time that Moody's actually not only notched other folks' ratings, but notched its own ratings.
I think the term notching can be applied very broadly. What we're doing here was basically saying that we expect there to be rating actions. We're taking a different assumption than what would be implied by using the public rating that's out there, because as you know, we're going to be taking rating action, as opposed to the type of notching that is done off of other rating agencies' ratings. It's not to say that we expect there to be rating actions on those, but given some of the differences in methodology, there could be differences in our ratings. We've seen that there may be differences in our ratings, and so to take that into account, we're using something a little bit more stressful. So I think while in both cases we're using a different rating than what's out there, it's for different reasons.
But this was the first time that Moody's had ever notched its own ratings on RMBS, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
I'm sorry, it's not the first time that we've put stresses on them.
The term in the press release was notching, though, right?
Right, and in this case, this is the notching. So you're correct in saying that it's the first time that we put notches on rating, but essentially what that does is it stresses the underlying assumption that we're using for default and recovery.
Press release on September 21st said notching, though, right?
It said that was the approach that we were taking.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying that the end result of doing the notching in the methodology is to stress the expected losses, and this is not the first time that we've stressed expected losses implied by the ratings.
It's the first time you've notched your own RMBS ratings.
Right, I've already said that.
Okay. You mentioned that surveillance took into consideration then the effect of the September 21st, 2007 decision on the CDOs that had been raided in the weeks leading up to this decision. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. What happened to the ratings of those CDOs?
I don't know about the specific transactions of the ratings. It would depend on the transactions themselves and how the assets within them were distributed.
Mm-hmm. So a CDO that was raided in the weeks leading up to the September 21st, 2007 decision would have been rated at a different methodology than those rated after September 21st, 2007, or excuse me, I shouldn't say different methodology. Prior to September 21st, 2007, the RMBS wasn't notched. After September 21st, 2007, the RMBS was notched for the ratings of the RMBS going into the CDOs that you were rating.
That is correct for those transactions for which we rated based upon the underlying pools. I had mentioned earlier that there are transactions that we rate based upon the covenants in the transaction. We're not looking necessarily at the specifics of the underlying pools because they could be managed. For those transactions that were not managed, that were static, then we were looking at the specific portfolios, in which case those would be notched.
Let me ask just sort of maybe a practical question. Mm-hmm. Two identical CDOs, mm-hmm. absolutely identical. All the collateral is identical. One's rated on September 19th, 2007, before the decision. One's rated on September 21st or 22nd, after the decision.
Mm-hmm.
Identical CDOs. Are the ratings going to be the same or different when you're notching after September 21st versus before September 21st?
Typically, as we're coming to a decision on methodology or parameters within a methodology, and as we have better understanding about what we are intending to do, we typically apply that thinking in the committee decision. So I don't know for sure if I looked at a specific deal on those two dates whether they would be different. It could be that the rating committees took into account some stresses on the portfolio assumptions that they're making, and they may be at a place where it's equivalent on one period to the next. So I can't say that on one day it would be one level and another day it would be another level, because the committee decision isn't just based upon one model run. It's based upon all the information that we know at any specific time, which could include information about upcoming rating actions.
Let me try to not make my hypothetical too complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Two CDOs. One, you're applying the notching to the RMBS. One, you're not. Identical RMBS, identical deals, assuming everything else equal.
Mm-hmm.
What does the notching do as a practical matter to the rating of the CDO with the RMBS notched?
It depends on the composition.
I'm saying everything's equal.
No, I'm not saying that mm-hmm. it depends on the compositions of the two compared to each other. I'm saying it depends on the actual composition, because the levels of notching that were used were different depending on the composition of the portfolios. So it could result in a large difference. It may result in not so large difference. It may just result in it also depends on what the credit enhancement is in those transactions.
Okay. Let's take the RMBS that was notched. Let's take the RMBS that was notched to the maximum.
Mm-hmm.
Two different deals, CDO deals. One, you're applying the notching. One, you're not applying the notching. The notching has the practical effect, if you're notching the RMBS underlying the CDO, the practical effect is the rating of the CDO tranches is lower. Is that the practical effect?
The practical effect is that the model results would be worse, and it would imply a worse rating.
Okay.
Whether the committee would, in fact, apply that rating or not is a different question.
Notching was bad for the rating. It was to lower the rating, right?
No, it was bad for the model results, and that was information that was fed into the committee. The committee is not deciding its rating just based upon that model run.
Okay. When was notching first applied to CDOs? You suggested it might have been applied before September 21st.
I'm saying that there were individual situations where we may have had information about a sector or... let me step back. I don't know of a specific instance where we have applied notching, but actually, that's not necessarily true. There was one deal where I was an analyst, in which we had a static portfolio. There were some concerns about the manufactured housing sector at that time, and where we went to the analysts and said, do you feel comfortable with the ratings? Do you think that these may be moving? Can you provide us with some information? And we used that information to stress those ratings based upon where they thought that those ratings could go to. So it was, in essence, basically notching those for the purpose of the analysis. It's not something that was typically done. It was when there were specific concerns about a sector or deals.
When was the decision, the notching described in the September 21st, 2007 press release? Mm-hmm. When was that application, that particular type of notching, mm-hmm. first applied? Was it a week before, 2 weeks before? Any idea?
I think the specifics of that, there may have been an email to the group to explain that this was what we were going to use. So that press release and that specific notching algorithm applied part and parcel to transactions was around that time. I don't know when that notice went out to the group. However, it was my understanding that as we were developing the notching, there were notching algorithms that were used to stress portfolios that committees looked at. So, but you're asking about that specific algorithm and that specific press release. There was a memo to the group to say, okay, this is the official one.
And when do you believe that memo was circulated to the group?
I don't remember.
Earlier we had talked about a conversation that you had with Eric Kolchinski where he expressed to you concern about continuing to rate ABS CDOs. Mm-hmm. At the time that Mr. Kolchinski expressed that concern to you, do you know if the notching that was described in the September 21st decision, mm-hmm. if that notching was something that was being contemplated internally at the time that Mr. Kolchinski came to speak to you?
I don't know for sure. We had talked about various ways in which to stress the underlying RMBS collateral. I don't know for sure if notching had been contemplated or not at that time.
Did any investors in CDO tranches, in CDO bonds, did any investors in 2007 complain to you?
I don't remember any specific complaint, except for I think we had a meeting with Fortress, who I don't know if they were investors or not at that time, but they were trading CDO tranches. As I said, I don't know if it was something where they were an investor or not. They had come to us with a view that they thought that certain CDO tranches should be downgraded. Essentially, they told us that they wanted to get to a specific price so that they could buy something. So that they thought that we should downgrade it, which would then allow them to buy it at the cheaper price. Other than that, I don't remember around that time any other specific conversations with investors.
Okay. Let's expand the question more generally. Mm-hmm. Has any investors ever come to you personally and said, expressed any complaints about quality of the ratings, the opinions that were expressed in the ratings, the accuracy of the ratings, or anything of the like? At any time, have any investors ever come to you and said, I think your ratings are wrong, or I think your ratings are too high, anything of the like?
Other than that discussion that I just mentioned, there was at some point a meeting that I attended of various investor community members from various asset management firms and insurance companies. I don't remember what the forum was. I was just asked to attend, and it was to discuss both RMBS and CDOs. A lot of it was really to kind of discuss with them what our views were and also to get feedback from them in terms of what their views were. Obviously, a lot of these parties were invested in RMBS and CDOs, and so that they did express to us their disappointment in the performance of the ratings. I think that was, I don't know for sure, I think that was after July 2007, in that time frame.
What investors do you recall being present? What firms, what persons?
I remember MetLife. Other than that, I can't remember a specific.
Who was present from Moody's?
So again, I can't remember everybody that was there. I remember Brian Clarkson being there, Noel Brennan, Michael Caniff. But there were others. I don't remember who was in.
And the only investor you can remember is MetLife?
Yeah, there were other. I don't remember any specific entity for sure, because they weren't necessarily people that I interacted with a lot. I knew of one person who was there from MetLife who I had seen in previous times, and that's why the company is familiar to me.
And who was that person from MetLife?
Her name is Lori Evangel.
Sorry, can you spell that?
Evangel, the same word.
Lori? You were asked at the permanent subcommittee investigation hearing about removal of analysts from deals that are being raised. And I want to go back to that, try to clarify what you were saying. Mm-hmm. I confess I went back and heard your testimony, listened to the record, and I didn't understand what you were saying. So I want to try to take the opportunity to understand what you meant. Let's take these sort of in questions, mm-hmm. and I'd like to definitely hear your explanation, but let's try to get the questions out of the way. Have you ever received a complaint from an investment bank or banker, mm-hmm. about any analyst on any of the deals that the bank was sending to Moody's?
Yes.
Okay. And in response to a complaint, have you ever removed an analyst from, let's separate this out. Have you ever, in response to a complaint from an investment bank or banker, ever removed an analyst from a transaction as it was going on?
If the complaint had to do with timing and the discussion between the banker and the analyst was as to how much time it could take and whether the person was available to start working on the transaction and whether they had the time to review it, that was typically something that, first, it was typically something that we tried to talk to the analyst about before it was assigned, but transactions don't always follow a specific time horizon. They may come in for an assignment today but not really get started on it for another 7 weeks. So that time was something that we asked analysts to manage and to come talk to us if there could be an issue. To the extent that timing was an issue, then I would typically go and talk to the analyst about what was the timing that was being talked about, you know, can you do it, can you not do it, what are the reasons, and does it make sense to either give you a backup or to, at this point, have you started working on the transaction? Does it make sense to assign it to somebody else? There have been situations there where we may have assigned the transaction. The deal hasn't really gone anywhere, but we've taken the analyst off because of that.
Sure.
We have gotten other types of complaints about, well, we think that we don't agree with the analyst's point of view. They're asking us for to explain certain things, or that they think that there's a risk here that we don't necessarily agree with. Those type of complaints, I cannot remember an instance where I took an analyst off a transaction.
Okay. So in terms of an ongoing transaction,
mm-hmm.
complaint by banker, you've removed an analyst for whatever reason, you've removed an analyst from a deal, from an ongoing transaction.
For timing reasons.
Okay. So
I mean,
yes.
To me, there's a very big difference between the two.
I want to know because
I don't want the answer to be misleading here. To me, there's a very big differences in terms of, you know, this is the time frame of the transaction, or is it something that an analyst can work on? And you know, you assign me this analyst, and you know, now they're telling me that they can't work on this transaction because they're going on vacation or whatever the case may be. That's something that I would have to have a discussion with the analyst to understand what's going on. So yes, I have remove people, but once again, more typically, we assign a backup so that when that person is gone, that person, the backup can take over.
Okay.
But to me, it's a very different question to say, you know, there's a complaint about the analysis, and there's a complaint about the view, and there's a disagreement between us about the transaction. Take somebody off.
For whatever reason,
that we have not taken people off.
For whatever reason, you've removed an analyst from an ongoing deal after receiving a complaint, for whatever reason, from a banker.
I think she just gave her answer.
I say it's not for whatever reason.
I think the question is misleading.
Well,
because I feel like you're trying to get me to say something that is not necessarily giving the whole picture here.
I was just trying to figure out sort of
if the
question was yes or no. I still don't understand. Have you removed an analyst from a deal from an ongoing deal as a result of a complaint from a banker?
I don't understand. I mean, I gave you my answers as to when we have removed an analyst. So your question is, have we removed an analyst?
Yes. Okay.
And I'm trying to clarify that the reasons for removing, there could be multiple reasons, and there are ones that I believe are valid and ones that are not.
I definitely want to get to the reasons. I just want to sort of figure out what was an area that's a yes or no, and what's an area. I definitely want you to list the reasons. I'm just trying to get at whether the actual question is a yes or no. And I appreciate that there's all sorts of reasons why you might remove someone, but I just wanted to figure out if that was an area that was a yes or a no.
I think I answered that.
Okay. Have you ever removed an analyst after receiving a complaint from a bank or banker from future deals with that particular bank or banker?
This is where I think there was confusion at the hearing. There's a difference between removal, in my mind, of an analyst from something they've been assigned to. So they've already been assigned to something, and now they're being removed from it, as opposed to the assignment of a new transaction to an analyst. And we don't assign analysts to relationships. I've mentioned before that we'd like to have a pool of analysts who are familiar with certain transactions, but we also have cases where we're assigning an analyst to a deal or a set of deals or a bank that has never worked with that bank or on those types of deals before. So the assignment is typically based upon our understanding of the complexity of the transaction, of the type of transaction that we're looking at, and of the timing of the transaction, as we've been told. And so the assignment is not something where we already had a predetermined idea of who should be on the transaction, and because of a complaint or complaints that we would take that person off the transaction. you had asked before whether there was a list. There is no list of transactions or banks where we've said that this analyst should not be on these deals.
Actually, I don't recall asking for a list, but
you asked earlier whether there was a list.
Let me try to ask it this way. Have you ever chosen not to assign an analyst to a deal based upon a prior complaint by a banker?
No.
Were you involved in assigning analysts, or was someone else involved in assigning analysts when you were the group managing director?
I was not involved.
Okay. Have you ever, when you were group managing director, told a managing director not to assign an analyst to a deal based on a prior complaint about that analyst from a banker?
No.
When you were group managing director, have you ever told a managing director not to assign an analyst to a particular bank or banker based on a prior complaint?
No.
Now, you had said earlier that there were instances where you might remove someone for various reasons, like timing and expertise.
I didn't say expertise, I just said timing.
Okay. Well, then I definitely want to get the reasons. Why would you not assign someone after hearing a complaint from a banker? What would be the various reasons?
We were talking at that point about removal.
Excuse me. Why would you remove someone? What would be a reason why you would remove someone from a deal after receiving a complaint from a banker? What were the reasons that you recall sitting here today removing someone from a deal?
As I mentioned before, the timing of when a deal would actually hit the analysis phase could differ. People would come in for assignments so that they know which analyst that they would be working on, but not necessarily contact that analyst for a number of days or a number of weeks. There are periods of inactivity in an analysis. You could talk to the analyst, let them know what kind of transaction is coming, and then basically that gets put on hold. So timing is very uncertain in these transactions. And if I assign the transaction to somebody because of the expected timing that we've been told by the banker, but the realistic timing is that that it coincides with either, essentially, the analysts are assigned multiple deals at any one time, and essentially they are being asked to manage the timing on those various deals, and to the extent that to the extent that they find multiple deals piling up at the same time, they may have to push back in terms of the timing that's being asked for by the bank. To the extent that it's a transaction that really hasn't gotten going yet, that's the most likely time that they would come back. That they would come back to us, meaning the analyst, the bank would come back and say, "Look, you know, we're ready to go, and your analyst is telling me that they're not able to get going because either they have this vacation that they're going on, or because they're telling me that their plate is full right now." And that would be an occasion where we would make a decision as to whether to assign a backup to that analyst, because there is maybe some period of time during which there would be a lot of overlap and they can work with a backup, or whether it makes sense to assign another analyst to that transaction whose timing works better for the transaction. That is the most typical case of timing being an issue for a transaction.
Okay. Any other reasons?
No. I mean, timing is the only reason why we should be doing that.
Have you ever received a complaint from a banker about the assignment of an analyst, either someone who had been assigned or someone who was to be assigned Have you ever received a complaint from a banker about an analyst and about the assignment of an analyst where you told the banker, no, I'm going to still assign the analyst to this deal or this transaction?
Yes.
Okay. What particular complaints do you recall where that occurred?
That is something that happens, actually, can happen quite often.
Okay. Give me one example of when that happened.
I was recently reminded of a situation, and I can't remember which bank it was, that complained. First of all, we typically assign either one or two analysts to each transaction, and we also assign a senior person, a committee chair level person, to the transaction. And that committee chair level person is really kind of the senior person that would be the first person that the analyst would go to if issues come up during the transaction. They're also the chair of the committee. The instance that I can think of, I can't remember whether the complaint was about the senior level person or the analyst, but it was a case where the banker did not want to be on the transaction. And I wrote back an email that basically said, look, I have confidence in him as an analyst. I think he's the right person for this transaction. He's the person that we're putting on.
Who was the banker that complained?
As I said, I can't remember.
What was the institution that complained?
No, I can't remember the bank.
Oh.
I was just reminded of it recently as we've been going through the hearings.
Okay. Who reminded you of it?
I was shown an email. I can't remember the specific email.
Do you remember the date of the deal?
No.
Year of the deal?
It was before. It must have been before 2007 because he was not an MD at that time.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember anything else about the deal? Any of the persons involved, manager, bank, anything?
I don't. It just stuck in my mind because it was about.
Okay. Any other examples that you can recall sitting here today where a banker complained about one of your analysts,
mm-hmm.
complained about the assignment of one of your analysts, and you told the banker no?
I can't remember a specific instance. However, it was typical for bankers to complain either about the analyst or certain issues that have been raised by the analyst. I can't recall a specific instance that I can tell you about. It was pretty much part of the day to day.
Would you ever not assign an analyst or recommend to your managing director not to assign an analyst based on personality conflicts?
It was not my role to recommend to the managing directors who to assign to a transaction, who not to assign to a transaction as a group managing director. As a team managing director who was assigning transactions, I think you're alluding to the discussion during the hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was recalling an instance in which I felt that an analyst was not being treated well by the banker, that they were being particularly abusive. And in that transaction, I brought in another senior analyst to reinforce our position as well as the analyst's position. I did not take that analyst off the transaction. And then in that type of situation, it may not necessarily be because in fact, in this instance that I was recalling, the banker did not ask me not to put that analyst back onto the next transaction. In fact, they wanted that analyst on the next transaction because they knew that person was familiar with the transaction. But I didn't feel comfortable putting that more junior analyst back on the next transaction because I did not like the way in which they were being treated by the banker.
And you mentioned you brought in another analyst to assist?
I brought in another senior person, in this case it was about to assist in some of the discussions with the banker.
And what was the year of this?
I don't remember.
What type of deal was it?
I believe it was a CDO squared. Once again, this should have been before Vaughan was an MD, so maybe 2005 at some point.
Do you remember the name of the transaction?
I don't know.
Senator Levin asked about, what about personality with moving
right.
people?
He was alluding to this specific instance that I had told his staffer prior to the hearings.
And he said sometimes relationships got very contentious. Sometimes we might switch people. Was this the instance that you had in mind when you said sometimes we might switch people?
For the next assignment.
But was this the instance that you had in mind
yes.
when you said we might switch people?
Right.
Okay.
But I made clear that we're talking about not during that transaction, but for the assignment of the next transaction where we would have to work with Vikram.
We're up to number six. So I'm showing you what's a partial chain of emails, and I will represent that I don't have the emails that precede this. This was produced to us in this format. It's a series of emails, first starting at the bottom, April 7, 2006, from you to several people. Then in June 28, 2006, an email from you to other people, re-deal assignment, Muni Healthcare Education, and it says, looks like they are going ahead with this deal. Please add Steve as the legal analyst. Update the closing to 7/30/2006 and the probability to 50%. First of all, who is Steve?
Steve Leoshi is a legal analyst in the group.
Okay. And then there's an email.
Yes, it was a legal analyst in the group. He still is in the group, but he's no longer. He's one of the team leaders in our surveillance group.
Okay. And Mr. Leoshi, is that how you pronounce his name? Is he still with Moody's?
Yes, he is.
Okay. There's an email above that, and it looks to be from yuri.yoshizawa@verizon.net mm-hmm. to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Can you, it dated August 17, 2006. What's going on there? It's like you're emailing that to yourself. I don't know if there's an explanation for that.
I don't know why I did that.
Okay. And then in August 17, 2006, you write to a series of people forwarding deal assignment, Muni healthcare/education. And why did Merrill Lynch ask for a new legal analyst?
This is an example of timing. It was a transaction that had been assigned. I don't remember exactly when. I think it seems like it was assigned in April of 2006. They had not started on the deal as of June 28th, but then I don't remember the specific communication, but it looks like they told us that they will be going ahead with this deal. And then basically the probability of it actually getting done at this point was not very high. It was still 50%, which is why I said we tended to apply some probabilities to whether a deal would actually happen or not. And they decided to move ahead with the deal, but there was also a long period of not doing anything from that period until August or July, actually. And when they came back to want to start working on the transaction, it was not there. So they wanted to start working on it, and so once again, we hadn't started on the transaction, so we switched the assignment from Steve. It was a timing issue.
So the reason why they requested the switch was purely for timing.
That's right.
Thank you. services. Do you ever have any direct dealings when you were group managing director with Chris Ricciardi?
Managing director. I may have. I don't remember a specific instance.
Okay. What about when you were the group MD? Did you interact with Mr. Ricciardi?
You just asked that.
I'm sorry. When you were the team MD. Apologize for getting the names confused. When you were team MD, did you ever have any dealings or conversations with Chris Ricciardi?
I know that I have had conversations with Chris Ricciardi. I don't remember what my role was at the time that we had any discussions. He wasn't someone that I spoke to often.
Mm-hmm.
But he is, as with many other bankers, we spoke on occasion, depending on what we were working on, depending on what the issue was.
Would you describe your relationship with Mr. Ricciardi as a contentious relationship?
I didn't really have a relationship with Mr. Ricciardi. It was, mm-hmm. There were instances where we got on the phone, and I don't remember any specific discussion with him.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember if Mr. Ricciardi had ever voiced any complaints to you about any analysts assigned to any of his deals?
Not that I can recall.
Okay. In your testimony, you described the relationship with bankers as often being contentious.
Mm-hmm.
What bankers did you have in mind of having a contentious relationship with?
I would say that it was a typical, the typical relationship between the rating agency and the banks were such that we were analyzing the risks of the transactions that they were bringing us to the extent that we raised issues as to why we may not be able to get to certain ratings, or we would analyze things in a certain way that they may or may not agree with or be happy with. They tended to push back, and so we were on different sides of typically of an issue. They wanted to get something done. We were seen as being kind of the thing that was in their way. And so the relationship with most bankers tended to be more adversarial than not.
With whom would you say you had the most contentious relationship?
It typically had to do with the transaction, so it wasn't a typical, day in, day out, we have an adversarial relationship, depending on the deal and what was going on and how difficult the issues were that we were dealing with. On any given day, there could be a specific banker on that day that could be the most aggressive or the most confrontational.
So across time, there's none that sticks out as being more contentious than others? Is there any one particular bank or institution that over time seemed to have been more contentious than others?
Not more than others, no.
Okay. What would make the relationship contentious?
As I just mentioned, they are trying to get their deals done. And we are raising, issues. We're analyzing their transactions. We're reviewing the documents, and to the extent that we're raising issues that they may not necessarily agree are issues, or they have a different opinion, that's going to create an adversarial relationship right there.
And how would you go about, what ways would you go about managing this contentious relationship? How would you approach this?
Essentially, the analysts were instructed to tell it as they see it. It's essentially review the information that they provided, do the analysis that they feel that they need to, provide information back to the banks as to how they were looking at things. explained where they thought that there were issues, where we had concerns as to the credit risk of the analysis. And essentially, the structure can choose to change the structure, to change the documentation, or accept that it was a risk that we would incorporate into our analysis.
And this contentious relationship, would it occur between analyst and banker?
It could, yes.
And could it also occur between team managing director and banker?
Yes.
And what about at your level, a group managing director, would it also occur there?
Yes.
And would bankers ever threaten to pull business away from Moody's on occasion?
Yes.
How often did that occur?
It was a typical threat.
Typical threat?
Yes.
And why would they make that threat?
They could make threats that they perceive would have some effect, but it didn't.
I mean, what would prompt them to make that threat? Was it because of a rating? Was it because of the timing of a deal? What sort of things would prompt a bank to make the threat of, I'm going to pull business away from Moody's?
It could be for a number of reasons where they may disagree. It could be because they don't agree with an issue that we're raising. It could be because they think that we should be able to do something faster. There are a number of reasons why they would complain and why they would threaten to do this or any number of things, which for the analyst, the complaint, the threat could be, I'm going to go talk to your manager, or I'm going to go over your head and go talk to somebody else. Or it could be, hey, we're not going to bring you our business. But, I mean, that's what I mean by there's an adversarial relationship, that they will say whatever they feel that they need to try to push the analyst, the committee chair, the senior shepherding analyst, the MD, and whomever, to try to get their point across.
And how would you go about ensuring that analysts didn't succumb to any of the pressures or threats that they might receive from a bank?
That was one of the reasons why we tried to put two analysts on every transaction for the support. Typically, if we put two analysts, it tended to be one of them tended to be more senior, tended to be someone who was more experienced at pushing back and not letting that bother them. We also mentioned that we had a second person, a committee chair level person, SVP, SDO. They were also put there for that support. We told analysts that, if they say that they weren't, go over your head, tell them go right ahead. And typically we would get on the phone with the analyst to help push back. And the last piece is that the ratings, and this is the last piece, but it's the most important piece, which is that the ratings are decided not by an individual analyst or an individual MD or an individual committee chair. It's decided by the committee. And so to the extent that there is pushback, we of course can always be, look, we're going to discuss this in committee, and the committee decision is the committee decision. It doesn't matter what you say to me. That's our process. So we have multiple ways in which to deal with it. The first one of the first jobs of a managing director is to protect the analysts and to make sure that what their views are and how they're analyzing the transaction is not influenced by the banker in that way.
How would you deal with the situation where, I'll strike that, some junior analysts have described to us, and junior folks, excuse me, not junior analysts, but junior people have described to us since that they felt like market share was important. And at the PSI hearing, people talked about market share and rating deals as being important. Did you feel at all that there was conflicting messages sent to the more junior people such that on the one hand, Moody's is supposed to have good market coverage, the right deals, and to be, you know, the leader in rating deals. And on the other hand, they're not supposed to succumb to the pressures and threats by the bankers. Did you feel like any of those messages were conflicting that were being sent to the more junior people under you?
It says that, you know, how people perceive what's going on is how they perceive it. I did not perceive that there was market share pressure. We were in the business of rating transactions. And I think that's something that's understood by everybody at all levels. I think it was understood by everybody at all levels that we were expected to try to rate deals that were brought to us to the extent that we were able to rate them and that we felt comfortable getting to a rating. Once again, not black and white, whether we can rate something or can't rate. Sometimes it is. Sometimes you feel that you just don't have the ability to rate something. You don't have the information to do so. You don't have the... It's something that's so complex that we wouldn't be able to do that. But for the most part, it's understood that to the extent that we feel that we can rate it, that we're expected to rate it. And that is the message that I understood from the time that I was an analyst all the way through my years up to now. That I did not feel that there was pressure on me from the perspective of either my compensation or job security or anything else that could affect my career at Moody's that was tied to whether or not we held or increased market share.
Was your compensation when you were team managing director tied in any way to market share?
I think we went through this before. I don't believe it was.
What about when you were group managing director? I don't think we covered that.
No, it's the same objectives as team managing director. It's not tied to compensation.
So market share didn't become important at all for compensation purposes when you elevated from a team MD to a group MD?
No.
Showing you what's been marked as Exhibit 8, which was a PSI document, PSI-Moody's 000086. It was Exhibit 19 of the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations Exhibit Book.
That's a stupid question.
Mm-hmm.
Marked as an exhibit to what, just so I understand? To the interview?
To the transcript interview.
To the transcript, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Marked as Exhibit 8, stated May 1st, 2006, written by Richard Michalek to you, CC Min, is it Sue?
Yes, Min Sue.
And the other name is?
Chen Su.
Re Magnolia 2006-5, Class Ds. In 2006, you were a team managing director, is that right?
That's correct.
And was Rick Michalek someone who worked under you at the time?
He did not report directly to me, but as I mentioned, people who report to others still work with different MDs.
And he was a legal analyst?
Yes.
Okay. If you flip to the last page of this exhibit, which is page 90, Bates number 90, rather. There's an email from, is that Fracha O'Driscoll?
Fiacra.
Excuse me?
Fiacra.
And Fiacra, who is Fiacra O'Driscoll?
Fiacra was a structurer at Credit Suisse.
And did Fiacra O'Driscoll at any time work for Moody's?
I don't think so.
Okay. And Fiacra O'Driscoll sends you this email, which is dated April 27, 2006, regarding the Magnolia 2006-5 Class D securities. Do you recall what that deal was?
I do.
Okay, what was that deal?
It was a Magnolia is a brand name that Credit Suisse used to issue synthetic CDOs, both corporate as well as RMBS. The issuances were each given a series number. Typically, the deals were differentiated. Each deal could be very different from the other, but the deals were based upon the year and the series number. So 2006-5 was the name of the deal. Magnolia 2006-5 was the name of the deal. A lot of times in synthetic transactions, the issuer can issue certain parts of a transaction on day one and then come back to issue different parts of the transaction. In this case, they had issued previously the other classes of 2006-5, and they were coming back and asking us to rate the Class D of the transaction, except for the fact that they're saying that the investors in Class D asked for a couple of changes to the portfolio. And that it was a transaction that had already been issued or that had already been traded. And so now they were asking us for a rating on the Class Ds.
I see. There are a couple things that, is it Mr. O'Driscoll?
Yes.
And Mr. O'Driscoll says in his first email to you, he says, Rick has said he won't be able to focus on it anytime soon and that we should expect a closing date in late, in all caps, May. Is the Rick there that he's referring to Rick Michalik?
Yes.
Okay. And he lists two letter paragraphs here. A, unless Moody's is unhappy with the documents that we closed the last transaction on, we don't think the documents need any changes. What's he explaining there, what you were just describing about how this was an ongoing series of transactions?
No, I think, okay. let me clarify what I
sure.
said. It's not an ongoing series of transactions.
Mm-hmm.
Magnolia is their brand. There are a series of transactions that are issued under the Magnolia name. Each of those series are very different transactions. They could be of very different types, corporate, RMBS, et cetera. In this case, the series is 2006-5. That's the series name.
Okay.
2006-5 is a transaction. And then there could be different classes of notes issued out of that specific series, so out of that transaction, and those notes can be issued at different times.
What do you understand Mr. O'Driscoll to be saying, and when he says, unless Moody's is unhappy with the documents that we closed the last transaction on, we don't think the documents need any changes?
He's assuming that because we already rated earlier classes of the 2006-5 transaction, that because the documentation is essentially the same except for the fact that we're issuing different securities out of them that may have their own coupon characteristics, as well as a couple of changes to the CUSIPs of the underlying RMBS, that it should be something where the documents, the base documents of the transaction that govern all the other classes should not necessarily need to change.
Okay. And was that something you agreed with?
Not necessarily. I, as I mentioned in my next email, I'm asking him to send the information to me so that I could at least take a look at what he's talking about.
And did you ultimately come to agree with that statement, though, that the documents didn't need any changes?
No, that's not necessarily for me to decide. That's something that the analyst needs to decide. That's the analytical process. I was looking to see, based upon what he said, whether the documents that he was sending over, at least not first flush, looked relatively similar to the ones that had closed before.
And when you say it was up for the analyst to decide, that's the legal analyst?
No, it's the analysts. It's, as I mentioned before, both the quantitative and legal analysts have responsibility for reading the transaction and doing whatever analysis they need to do to be able to rate that transaction.
Okay. And B says, I'm going to have a major political problem if we can't make this short and sweet, because even though I always explain to investors that closing is subject to Moody's timelines, they often choose not to hear it. What is Mr. O'Driscoll's trying to convey there to you? What do you understand him to be conveying?
I understand him to be conveying that he wants to get this done quickly, which is, as I mentioned before, one of the pressures that the banks had were putting on us. This is one way. You would ask, how does it manifest itself? Here's an example of that.
Okay. You write back to him on same day, April 27th, and ask that, can you please send over the documents blacklined against the other 2006-5 documents to me? You say, please send over the black lines so that I can see them and so that any other analyst that I sign can use them for review.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Was that typical that you would request black lines in these sorts of circumstances?
It's typical that when they send over documents, if they are similar to a previous transaction that they've done, that they would send over both clean as well as black line versions.
Okay. And I want to ask what you're mean in the second paragraph when you say, also the terms of my fee arrangement are very clear on the fact that the portfolios must be identical.
Mm-hmm.
One of the key reasons why the fees are much lower compared to the full waterfall deals is because they are usually very similar from deal to deal in terms of structure and documents. And you continue on. What do you mean by that?
Well, first, let me just point out the reason I was asking for the black line, and I explained it in the email itself, is I'm basically concurring with or explaining Rick's concern that even though you say that this could be something that's very simple to review, it should be exactly the same as the last set of documents that we've seen, that in fact it could be very different. So essentially I'm explaining why Rick had the concern about timing, and also to say, send it over, let's take a look at it. In terms of the fee discussion below...
Well, may I interrupt there for a moment? You said I was responding to Rick's concern. Had Rick Michalik expressed concern to you prior to you sending this email?
Not responding to Rick's concern, but essentially FIACRA is raising a timing issue here.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to tell me here that this should be a very quick analysis. He's saying that in that first email that he's sending me. And I'm saying, okay, you're telling me that this is essentially the same documents as we just reviewed, that it may not necessarily, I'm asking you to send information to me because we have concerns that even though you say that may not necessarily be the case.
But you mentioned I was responding to Rick's concern. Did Rick Michalik express a concern to you prior to you sending this April 27th?
I corrected myself. I said responding, but I said explaining Rick's concern.
Okay.
I mean, I'm just saying that I wrote in the email that I was explaining to FIACRA. I believe Rick's concern is that despite what you say regarding them coming from the same issue, where the constituting documents may be very different.
Okay.
So I was just explaining to him why, even though he's telling me that this is the same deal, that this is why we're asking for more information to make that decision. In terms of the fee question,
mm-hmm.
The terms of the fee agreements for these synthetic transactions was that even if the transaction is substantially the same as the one that we just previously rated, to the extent that they change even one name in the underlying pool, that it becomes a new transaction from an analytical point of view. And so essentially I'm explaining to him that I'm going to charge you as if this is a new transaction, even though you're telling me that this is another class of the same transaction, because even though it's another class, you're telling me that you're changing a couple of uses.
And where are you saying you're going to charge him for a new transaction in this email?
The stray, because it has the different QSIPs, would be considered a different deal under my pricing, i.e. $85K for a static deal.
Okay. And he goes on, and you have some communications with him. And feel free to read those if you want. We can take some time, but I want to get to the email that's ultimately on the front page there about this deal. And if you want to go back, well, I'm happy to go back. But well, before we get to the email on the front page, I guess let's take one more additional email leading up to that. May 1st, 2006 at 10:41 a.m. This was your email on May 1st to Rick Michaelet and
Chen Su.
Rick Chen, I asked Roland and Fakra to send over the documents for the new trades, blacklined against the one you closed, not the new ones that Rick is working on with men. I looked through the black lines, and it looks like the changes are minimum, e.g. names, pricing, dates, etc., except for the swap, which has more changes due to the removal of funding language. Let's first take that first paragraph. How do you reconcile what you say in this paragraph with what you stated a few minutes ago about how it was up to the legal analyst to determine these questions?
I'm telling them that this is what I see. It's still up to the legal analyst to come back and say, look, when I look at this document, you know, what you're seeing here is, as I said, I'm doing a very high-level look to see what, you know, what they're telling me. It's up to the legal analyst to look at that and say, no, or not just the legal analyst, I mentioned both analysts, to look at it and say, no, this is a substantial, this is a different deal. What you're seeing here is not a true black line against what we saw before. So I'm just saying then what I see in the black line, but it's not an analysis of it. It's up to them to do the fuller read of the actual document, not just the black line.
Well, why did you express any opinion in your email here? Mm-hmm. Why express any opinion if it's ultimately up to the legal analyst?
I'm essentially asking them to let me know what it's going to take to be able to do the analysis, given that from my view it looks very similar to the last analysis. So I need to get an idea of how much time it should truly take to do the transaction. And I'm relying on the analysts to explain to me what that is. I can take a look at something very quickly and say, you know, it seems to be something that could be done relatively quickly, but it's up to the analyst to say, you know, look at it and say, well, no, that's not true because of X, Y, and Z. So that's the typical typical discussion that could be had. On the surface, things could seem a certain way, and then typically the analyst would let me know what's really going on in the transaction as they do the analysis or as they've looked at the transaction more.
Where are you asking them, though, to tell you how long it will take?
This is a typical discussion that we have. I don't necessarily have to say, you know, how long will it take you. If I'm making a presumption that is incorrect, then it's something that analysts more often than not will tell me. Because the typical discussion that we have when we assign a transaction is, how much, what's on your plate, what's going to get done. They're telling me that this is the case. Take a look at it. And then if something comes back as, this isn't what they told me, this is different, that's a typical discussion that we have in discussing any transaction.
Are you asking any questions, though, in your email here?
I'm not phrasing it in the form of a question, but as I said, these are the typical discussions that we have on a transaction. It doesn't look like, on the surface, it doesn't look like much to me. The analyst could say, you're wrong, you're looking at it on the surface, but that's not the case. As I said, that's just, I'm telling them what my assumption is based upon what I see on the black line, but it's typical for someone to come back if they disagree with me and say, you know, you're wrong, it's you know, they're telling you something different, or they're providing you something that's not accurate.
And if you could flip to the front page, the response that Mr. Michalek gives to your email, May 1st, 2006, Rick Michalek to yourself, copying Minzu and Chinsey. Just want to ask you what you understand Mr. Michalek to be meaning by his response. He says, I am worried that we are not able to give these complicated deals the attention they really deserve, and that they, CS, are taking advantage of the light, in quotes, review, and the growing sense of, quote, precedent. What do you understand Mr. Michalek to be meaning when he said that to you?
After I received this email, I remember going to talk to him because a number of the items that he mentioned in here I found to be disturbing. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to understand what he meant by these things. Because, as you say, to me there are some assumptions in here on his part. In his statements that, as I said, I find disturbing to the extent that he thinks that we need to do a light review. We need to do an appropriate review of the deal. And that's appropriate based upon reading through the entire deal if necessary. As I said before, this was a transaction that had just been rated and that he had just been the analyst on. And so I was also concerned that he had issues with the documentation and with his term with fixes and precedent in this email, because he was one of the panelists that was on this transaction. And to the extent that things have not changed from that transaction to this transaction, I needed to understand why he thought that was an issue.
What did you understand him to be meaning when he said light review?
That's exactly what I went to talk to him about, is that I was disturbed that he thought that this required a light review.
And what did you subsequently learn from talking to him he meant by light review?
He meant that he thought that a light review would just look at the changes from last deal to this deal.
And did you believe that that was what was being asked of him to do?
I had also raised in one of the previous emails where I had said that if you, regarding any new changes you and Min are asking for, we can ask for the same changes here if you let me or Chen know what those changes are. There were two deals that were going on at the same time. If you look at the first paragraph on that email on May 1st, I mentioned, and the new ones that Rick is working on with Min, he was working on two separate CS transactions, one with Min, one with Chen. Even if we had just finished the transaction, we were treating this as a new transaction. So I had even mentioned in the previous email that to the extent that there's something that on this transaction that you think needs to be addressed, then, you know, that's something, you know, let me know what's going on. So I don't necessarily agree that we just look at the changes from the last deal to this deal and that's it. That said, I think he was assuming that light review meant that we do something like that.
Do you think that your statements about I looked through the black lines and it looked like the changes are minimal, names, pricing, dates, etc., your statement about it shouldn't be too difficult given the minimal changes, and your statement about the changes to the model shouldn't be difficult to run. Is it your understanding that he interpreted those statements to mean that you were asking for a light review? Is that what you took away from your conversations with Mr. Michalek?
We did not have something called a light review. There was no such thing as a light review. The analysts were required to do the analysis for the transaction and bring it to committee. To the extent that they thought that there was something that was problematic in this transaction, it was something that they should have brought up to committee. My only comment here is that he, compared to the transaction that he had just rated prior to this, that the only changes that I could see that they were highlighting were that they changed the dates. As I mentioned, this was issued a little bit later, the names and the pricing on the transaction, on the tranches. To the extent that there were other issues that they thought should be brought up, I'm asking them to bring them up to me and let me know if there's something. So we can ask for those same changes here as well, but you know, let me know what's going on.
Is the term light review a term that you've ever used?
No.
There's a reference here to precedent. Mm-hmm. What did you understand him to mean when he says, and the growing sense of precedent? Mm-hmm.
As deals, I mentioned before that the market and deals were continually changing and that we had to address those changes deal by deal. You had shown me another email before where a banker tried to say that one deal was exactly like the one before. In the same way, we have to address the issues as they come up and in a way that is satisfactory to a committee to get to the ratings that they vote on. To the extent that we, as a committee, come to a decision that we could put a rating on a transaction or on a security that has a certain feature to it and a certain mitigant to it, it becomes a precedent for a future transaction that may have the same risk. As well, it's something that we got comfortable with. So,
why was that a concern to Mr. Michael? Did he tell you?
To the extent that I mentioned before, the ratings are decided upon by a committee. Not, in fact, it's typical for people to disagree during the committee as to the risks and the mitigants and the impact on the rating for those. To the extent that one person may feel that a mitigant may not necessarily be the perfect mitigant, or they may choose to raise that committee, they may choose to vote for a different rating because of that. But to the extent that, and to the extent that he may or may not have felt comfortable with the with what, as he calls in quotes, the fixes that they used for the previous deal that he rated, that may be something that he was raising as a concern, because even though he rated the previous deal, even though he was part of the rating committee, even though he voted for a rating, I don't know what the rating was that he voted for, whether it was the rating that eventually was assigned to the transaction or not. But I think he was expressing that he still had some concerns about that specific way in which a feature was treated or approached.
And he uses precedent in quotes there. Was that a term that you had used in conversations with your managing directors, the phrase precedent?
Precedent is something that's typically used in just normal conversation when we're talking about a precedent deal or a precedent that was set in a feature that was done or a methodology that was used. I don't know why he put it in quotes. He puts a lot of things here in quotes. I don't know why.
He later on, speaking of putting things in quotes, in the fourth paragraph, he puts light review again in quotes.
That's right.
You said you went and talked to him. When you talked to him, did you ask him, Rick, where'd you get this idea of light review? Who told you that? Where'd you get this term? Why'd you put it in quotes?
I don't remember the specific conversation. I remember going to talk to him about this because mm-hmm. it raised concerns to me.
Yeah.
I don't remember if I said to him, where did you get this term, or how did this come up? It's concerning to me that he thought that there was a review that was light.
Did he ever tell you where he got the term light review?
No. Okay. Well, not that I can. I don't remember having that discussion. He may have said something, but I don't remember.
Okay. in the third paragraph, he says, not that the chosen stopgap measure was not good enough, just that the weight of this is what we have done in the past and have gotten comfortable with is growing with every deal, and the incentive to unravel the documents and try to understand just how the complicated pieces fit together is growing even smaller. Did you ask him what he meant by that statement?
We did not go through his email piece by piece. I mean, I went next door. His office was next door to talk to him about what his concerns were about this deal and about the review. So I did not say, what did you mean in this paragraph or by this phrase?
Does this paragraph, though, the third paragraph, when he talks about that the weight of this is what we have done in the past and have gotten comfortable with is growing with every deal, and the incentive to unravel the documents and try to understand just how the complicated pieces fit together is growing ever smaller? Was this concept of was this concept discussed with him? Did you in any way say, what do you mean by that? Not necessarily that phrase, but did you ever ask him about his concerns about the incentives to unravel the documents going smaller and that this growing weight that he describes in this paragraph? Did you talk to him at all about this?
I mentioned before that some of the with legal analysts, there's a when they come to Moody's, and what they're asked to do is to review the documentation, to identify the risks, and to make a determination as to whether the mitigants that are involved or not are appropriate, and not redraft a document or not necessarily change a document. It's not their job to lawyer the deal. It's their job to be a credit analyst on the transaction. The concept of unraveling the documents. It's not our job to unravel the documents. Our job is to review the documents. Our job is to review the structure of the deal and to make a decision on a deal-by-deal basis as to whether the documentation, the structure, all the risks in the transaction as we see them are ones that we can analyze and feel comfortable that we can come to a rating decision. He talks about the stopgap measures being, he's saying that not that the chosen stopgap measure was not good enough. Essentially, that is the decision that we're making in a rating committee for a transaction is are the provisions that are specific to this deal sufficient for the risks that are presented in this deal? We would have to make a decision as to whether the next deal that's brought to us, they may use the same, and he uses the term stopgap, is the same provision, whether the same provision is applicable given the other risks in the transaction or not. And to the extent that it's not, just because it was used in a previous transaction doesn't necessarily mean that it should be used as precedent or that it should be in the terms of that other email that you showed me, grandfathered for a deal. So we do look at these deals on a deal-by-deal basis. We don't go back and say, just because we used this as something that we got comfortable with in the previous deal, by you automatically using this provision in your new deal, that we will automatically be okay with it. It's going to depend on the specifics of that transaction. If we're not okay with it, we're going to say we're not okay with it. And if that means that they're going to have to change their deal in order to address the risks that we're pointing out for that new transaction, that's going to be it. So my concern was, why do you feel that you cannot make comments on a new deal just because we had done or our committee had gotten comfortable with something for a previous deal? Now, if it's the same exact situation and it's the same exact risk and it's being addressed the same exact way and you are the same analyst on this deal and this deal, I'd like to know why you think that it may work in this case but not work in another case. And those are the types of discussions that we would have as we're discussing deals or within a committee.
you tell Mr. Michalek that it wasn't his job to unravel the documents?
I don't think I used that term, but it was an issue that did come up from time to time with Rick, and it was something that we did talk about.
What did you do after talking to Mr. Michalek? Mm-hmm. Did you investigate his concerns?
Investigating means, for me, sitting down with the analysts, including Rick, to understand what the concerns are. And if it's a concern that a certain type of review is expected by him, then it's my job to tell him if that's his perception, then that's not the case. I don't remember the specific, once again, I don't remember the specific details of the discussion that we had. We talked about this deal. I asked him about what provisions he found to be uncomfortable. And you know, he had mentioned before that even though he's raised this couple issues, he's not saying that it's not that they're not good enough. He was talking about the overriding concerns that, as he puts it, just the weight of this is what we've done in the past, and you get comfortable and you do that in the future. What I explained to you, which is you're expected to look at these transactions on a deal-by-deal basis. I remember having that discussion. So the typical thing that would happen, whether it's a banker that raises a complaint or an analyst who has a concern, is that we're going to go straight to the analyst and say, what's going on here? What is the concern?
What other analyst did you go to after receiving Mr. Michalek's email? What other analyst?
I may have spoken to Min or Chan. I don't remember.
Anyone else you recall?
I'm listening.
Okay. In the next paragraph, fourth paragraph, he says, when you add a reduced fee to the scale, mm-hmm. it definitely tips it over to light review. Were there reduced fees associated with some deals? And what does he mean, or what do you understand him to mean when he says, when you add a reduced fee to the scale?
I understood this to mean that he thought that we negotiated a lower fee because it was a deal that was similar to the previous deal. I explained to him that was not the case, that we were charging the standard fee for this type of deal. And that's even in the earlier email, that we were treating the deal as if it was a new deal. That said, I also explained to him that regardless of what the fee arrangement is, it's not his concern as to what the fee is. His responsibility is to make the transaction as he sees fit. Mm-hmm.
At any time in your talking to him, mm-hmm. Did you ever say to him, Rick, I never used the term light review. I don't know where you're getting that from. Did you ever say that to him?
I don't remember if I did or not.
I've counted just by my quick count, and the document will speak for itself, that there's four times in his email to you he's used light review, and then at least three of the four here he puts it in quotes.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever learn at any point in time where he got this idea of light review, this phrase? Did he ever learn from anyone that, hey, he heard that from so-and-so, or he heard that from this bank? Did you ever understand where he got this term?
It's not a term that is or was typically used. As I said, my understanding of what he thought a light review meant was because this field was very similar to the one that he had just created, and so that he thought that what was required was essentially only looking at the changes from last deal to this deal. That was the discussion that we had.
Does the phrase light review cause you concern when you heard it? Did it cause you concern? Did it bother you that he used the phrase light review?
The phrase doesn't bother me. What I thought he expected to do on the transaction bothers me.
Mm-hmm. And did it bother you at any point that he was using it in quotes?
It didn't. There's a lot of things in quotes in here that are essentially his views. I mean, he's using it as quotes when he talks about, what he's talking about is a reduced fee, for example. But I mean, it concerned me. The substance of it concerned me than the wording that he was using.
Did you give Mr. Michalik additional time to review the documents and get comfortable in response to his complaints here?
I don't remember what the timing or the outcome was of the transaction.
Do you remember when the deal closed?
I don't.
He says at the bottom, if headlines are going to be made, this structure may be just the source of error that in hindsight we really will wish we had given more time.
Mm-hmm.
Did that prove to be true?
This was an ABS CDO, along with many other ABS CDOs. I'm pretty sure that this was probably downgraded pretty severely. It was downgraded because of the underlying assets performance, not because of the structural issues that he's raising here.
Remember how this deal ended up performing?
As I said, I don't know about the specific deal, but as I would assume that just with all the other ABS CDOs of this vintage, that it performed pretty poorly. But not because of administrative expense caps.
Did any other analyst other than Mr. Michalik ever express to you concern about the lack of time to review a deal?
Yes.
Okay. What other analyst do you remember ever expressing concern to you about the lack of time to review a deal?
The typical back and forth between the banker and the analyst is that the banker wants things to get done yesterday. The analyst is saying, I need more time to get it done.
What analyst do you remember saying that?
Almost every analyst on every transaction.
Okay.
I mean, that's the typical, as I mentioned, it's a typical discussion. It's the typical type of thing where they're asking for us to push back.
Did the frequency of those concerns increase in 2006 and 2007 as more deals were being rated by Moody's?
We did have a concern, as I mentioned, a lot of the discussion between the MDs and the bankers had to do with pushing back on timing. We also incorporated into our standard fee applications a rapid turnaround fee that was intended to be high, to be a deterrent. To push people back on timing. So there was a constant pushback from our part, whether it was the analysts, committee chairs, or the MDs on timing of expected timing, so managing that expectation.
And were there complaints as well from analysts and managing directors about the amount of resources that were being devoted to rating deals?
It was extremely challenging time in terms of resources. And in terms of the workflow, people went from working typical 9 to 5, 9 to 6 type hours to working many more hours. So it was something that we were focused on. It was something where we constantly had, we were hiring and interviewing almost constantly during that time period.
And from 2006 to 2007,
mm-hmm.
How many more analysts were there devoted to ABS CDOs?
Pretty much everybody in the group could rate ABS CDOs. Analysts were trained to work on multiple types of transactions so that we could be we can be flexible in terms of assignments, depending on timing. I don't remember what the actual numbers were in the group, but the bottom line was we constantly had open positions, and we were interviewing to fill those positions, and even as we filled positions, we were asking for more positions.
Do you have any role in the rating of financial guarantors?
I was not part of the analysis or the committees. The financial guarantor who, like ours, was a user of other groups' ratings. So from the point of view that they used our ratings and our analysis in their own analysis, we were involved, but not directly involved in the rating of them.
Did the financial guarantor group, though, report out to you?
No.
Okay. Who did they report out to?
There were different people at different times. I don't remember the timing of who was responsible for the group.
Do you recall who was in charge of that group?
It changed over time. I don't remember who. I know that Jack Doerr was a team MD in that group.
Can you spell his name?
D-O-R-E-R.
Okay.
First name Jack.
Anyone else that you recall involved in the financial guarantor ratings?
His boss for some time was Ted Collins, but I don't know if he was always responsible for financial guarantors. I know Laura Levenstein at some point was responsible for them at a higher level. I'm not sure. I don't remember who else. It was a different line of business outside of structure.
Okay. Why don't we take? We've been going for a little while. Why don't we take a 5-minute break?
Okay.
Go off record at 4:15. Go back on record. It's 4:22. I promised that we would go through, and I want to stick to my promise, the concept of sort of how deals came about, how deals evolved, the process of that. Very sort of what happened, you know, how ratings come about, the process. Deals presented, analysts assigned, committees and all that. We've heard quite a bit about how that process works, but if you can just take me through sort of, and I know no deal is typical, but take me through a hypothetical CDO. And if you want to differentiate between an ABS CDO, cash CDO, with RMBS collateral or synthetic, I'll leave that up to you if there's a difference. But can you take me through sort of how a deal comes in, to whom it comes in, how analysts are assigned, just the process, the nuts and bolts sort of process of what goes on in rating a deal.
Typically, the deal would come in through the structure calling or the banker calling the team MD. They may call a senior analyst or an analyst, but they'll typically be directed to the MD. The MD may ask some questions about the transaction to get a little bit of background so that they understand what kind of transaction it is. They will then essentially tell them that they'll get back to them with an analyst assignment. Typically, the MD then would talk to certain analysts about their timing, about, you know, is this something that's familiar to you? Have you seen this? And based upon people's availability, and their understanding of the complexity and the timing of the deal as it's been described to them, they will assign an analyst or two analysts to the transaction.
May I interrupt here? At the time that analysts are assigned, mm-hmm. do you already have the deal documents in-house?
Typically not.
Okay.
typically the deals evolve as they come in. There will be some cases, as the Magnolia transaction, for example, where they already traded the deal. They already actually issued the transaction, and now they're coming to us for a rating on something that's already been sold. That case, there is an actual document that's already there. A typical CDO, however, will not have executed documents and certainly not a final draft of documents. Sometimes it'll just be a verbal explanation. Sometimes there's a term sheet. Sometimes there is a deal that they will reference and say it's just like this deal. And usually the MD will rely on at least one of the analysts to call the banker to get more details and to come back and say, okay, this is what they explained to me. Let me know if it's different. That's what I mean by that typical discussion, because we're told something at a very high level as MDs. The analysts will get more information, and deals change as they're worked on as well. So we expect that information to come back to us. The managers, the MDs at that time, some point in 2007, I can't remember when our policy changed, the MDs were responsible for the fee arrangements. And so once we had a better idea of the transaction, then we would send out the rating application or explain what the fee arrangement would be for that transaction. And then once we have analysts that we know can work on it, given the timing, given the type of deal it is, I mentioned we also assign a committee chair level person, and that could be the MD. It could be an SVP or SEO, basically somebody who could chair a committee.
I'm sorry, you used some acronyms there.
A managing director or a senior vice president, senior credit officer. These are the most senior vice president and senior credit officer are the most senior analysts within the group.
And they would be assigned to do what?
To pretty much be the shepherding, be the senior person who understands what's going on in the deal at any point in time, and they would typically also act as the committee chair for the transaction. Mm-hmm. Essentially, it's one of the senior people. It could be the MD themselves, or it could be one of the senior people who best knows the methodology, the product, is essentially part of the steering committee for any specific asset class. Mm-hmm. And they may be the person that the MD asks to call the banker and get some more information, or maybe a specific analyst that's asked. Once the assignment is made, it's something that is put into a system, along with a expected closing date, so that we have some idea. Also, most transactions typically went through at least two committees, so we would have a what we call pre-pricing committee, that would be the time at which the banker wanted to price their transaction. We would try to do a committee before that, and then we would do a final closing committee. There may be other committees as well to decide issues that may come up along the way. But that's something that we also ask for in terms of timing.
And let me ask a few questions, if you don't mind, if I can interrupt you as you go on this. I don't like to interrupt the witness, and I apologize in advance for doing it, but I want to ask you a few specifics about what you've described. After you've assigned the analyst, mm-hmm. is that when you get the documents? When do you get the documents, the deal documents?
It really depends on the transaction. If it's a transaction that is based on a previous transaction, the banker may send over the documents from that previous transaction so that people have a sense of how the deal will work. Sometimes they will send over a black line of a previous transaction to show where they think the changes are going to be. Sometimes it'll be a whole new document, the documents typically go through multiple iterations due to comments made by multiple parties, the LALA manager, certain investors, the trustee, rating agencies. As the structure amends the transaction, the documents need to be updated. So those are updated every whatever number of days or however often they need to make changes. And those documents are sent to us as well. When they send over the first set of documents, it really depends on the transaction. It could be the day after the deal is assigned. It could be a few days into it. It could be a couple weeks into it. Depends.
And you had described, I believe, the setting of some dates.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just take January 2007 as the date for this example. In January 2007, about how long would you have in a typical ABS CDO deal with RMBS collateral, cash CDO deal? Typically, how long would the process go on from the date that the managing director first gets the call to the date that the deal is finally closed? What's the time frame there, typically?
There's a vast range. It could go from it depends on the structure of the transaction.
Mm-hmm.
It could go from a couple weeks, 2 weeks at the low end to several months.
Okay. And same question with respect to the time frame for a synthetic CDO, mm-hmm. with tied to referencing RMBS collateral.
I was actually incorporating that.
Oh, you're incorporating that.
The short end would be a simpler structure, which in my mind would be a synthetic, which does not have a lot of waterfall features to it. That would be on more the lower end in terms of amount of time, and the length depends not just on the analysis, but also it depends on other things that are beyond anything having to do with rating agencies. It could be investors and their timing, or you know, market considerations. Whatever, it's really kind of something that's going on outside the rating process.
What's the shortest time frame you remember for a CDO?
We have, as I mentioned before, we started incorporating what we called rapid turnaround fees.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, we said that if it's, I can't remember, within, if they're asking for something to be done faster than 10 days, it was a large fee. We typically applied that as a deterrent. I mean, that was the thinking behind it. We really didn't want to have to meet those time schedules. And in fact, in the rating application, we say that that's only if we make a decision that we can. If there was a transaction that is purported to be, and in truth is, very much exactly like a last transaction, that could be done very, very quickly. It's really up to the analysts to take a look at it, make a decision as to whether they still feel comfortable given any additional information that they've learned, and be able to take that transaction to committee.
And when was the rapid turnaround fee implemented?
I don't remember the dates. I don't remember the year.
You don't remember the year?
No.
Was it already in place when you became Group MD?
I believe it was.
Yeah. And so, if I heard you correct, if it was under a certain time period, did you say 10 days?
I think that was the first standard CDO.
You charge more for rate.
We essentially, it was kind of a warning to say if we do, I can only think of one instance where we may have actually charged it, where they didn't back off and say, okay, you know, we can live with a longer timeline.
So there was only one instance where the fee applied because the deal was under 10 days?
Yeah, that's. I can only remember one instance where it did apply. There may have been other instances with other MDs where it may have applied, but it wasn't something that I was involved in.
Were there ever any instances where the deal was rated in under 10 days, but you chose not to apply the rapid turnaround fee? In other words, did you waive the fee on some instances?
Not on the deal that I was responsible for, but once again, I don't know what other MDs may have done.
Okay. What about when you were Group MD? Do you know of any deals that were handled by the MDs underneath you, where the rapid turnaround fee may have been waived?
it wasn't something that I would have gotten involved in.
Okay. So when you were group MD, you weren't involved in the actual fee and fee discussions? That would have been at the team MD level?
At the team MD level, yes.
Okay.
If there were a dispute, that may be raised to my level. But in the normal day-to-day, it was a lot of leeway given to the team MD to make a decision as to whether something should apply or not.
There have been some allegations that we've heard about banks. I think the term was called jamming, but it may not be the term of art. But sending over a deal and saying, you've got a week to rate this or 2 weeks to rate this, and I want you to rate it right, you know, rate the deal or we're walking away, and you only have a certain time period to do it, where banks may have waited to send the deal over. It was described in one instance is jamming. Again, I don't know if that's a term of art. Is that something that occurred?
First, that's not a typical term.
Fair enough.
I mentioned before that timing was a typical issue that was discussed, discussed. It was a typical point of pushback. So, yes, people would come and try to bankers would come and try to present aggressive timelines. As I said before, it was basically up to us as to whether that we could meet that timeline or not. If we felt that this is not something that we could do within that timeline, we would typically push back. And do includes the fact that you have other deals that have entered the queue before your deal. And to the extent that, look, we've got all these analysts, their plates are full, we can't accommodate the timeline that you have. It could be because the deal requires more time to analyze than you're asking for, or it could also be because you can't start. I mean, maybe the actual analysis itself may only take 1 day, 2 days. It could be something very simple, but look, you're in a queue, and so. That's just the way it is. I mean, we try to accommodate based upon people's schedules and what they have on their plates and whether they can do it or not. But as I mentioned before, that was a typical point where there was a lot of pushback at every level, analyst, committee chair, MD.
Mm-hmm. And did this time pressure on deals did that become more pronounced in 2007?
I don't know if it became more pronounced. I mean, it was always there. Given that the number of deals grew every year, I think that the queues got longer. So I would think that they, if I think about it, yes, there probably were more complaints than before. As you mentioned before, synthetics typically could take a shorter amount of time to take a look at. So I think the view was, look, this should, in our view, this is something simpler. That's something that we can, and I'm saying by our view, I'm talking to the bank, as the bank is speaking, that they're thinking that this is something that should be able to be turned around quickly. It's something that's just like the last deal. This is something that, that they want to get done quickly because they're able to pull the deal together more quickly because it's synthetic, and so they're going to put more pressure on us to try to do that. So was that pressure there? Absolutely. And I think there was definitely more as time went on because just the sheer number of deals as well as the execution time on their side.
I took us off your chronology that you were given, and I want to bring you back to that.
Okay.
So the analysts are assigned.
Mm-hmm.
You said a date is set.
Not set.
Okay.
We're asking. The banker will let us know what their anticipated timeline is. That they expect to price by this date and they expect to close by this date, but those dates are always very fuzzy. They're not, as I mentioned, the timing is very hard to predict. And so it's very hard to say that, you know, when it comes in today that it's actually got price on that date and close on that date. Sometimes it gets pushed for weeks or months even, as you saw this in one transaction.
Mm-hmm.
So it's they try to give a guesstimate as to when they think, when they'd like to get it done. As I said, if it's aggressive from the beginning, we're pushing back before we even assign the deal. But what could happen is that, it could be that at that time they don't know what the dates are. It could be that they're just giving us a date and they're saying, you know, this is a kind of our target. So whatever they give us, we try to use that in assigning an analyst as well as putting it into our database so we can track who's being assigned to what and when are these deals expected to be live and to be busy.
So once you have the estimated timetable, you've assigned the analyst,
mm-hmm.
Then what comes next? That you get the docs?
you're very focused on the docs. When
do you get the docs?
I think you're a lawyer, I understand that you want to know when the docs are. But it really depends on the transaction. It could be that the modeling starts much earlier based upon and the modeling can start based upon many different things. It could be based upon a term sheet. It could be based upon basically a portfolio that's sent over. It's a static transaction.
Mm-hmm.
It could be based upon a model that the banker has coded up, and so they're sending us information that so we can see how they were thinking about the structure and how it would work. So the modeling work would typically start before the actual documentation work starts. And the documents would come as, and there'd be multiple documents in a typical synthetic CDO. The biggest document would be, the most important would be the credit default swap agreement. There may be a master agreement if it's issued out of a structured note program. There would be base documents for that program, or there may be a trust agreement for a trust that's being set up for a cash deed CDO. There's typically an indenture or a trust deed and security agreement, depending on whether it was done under English law or U.S. law. There could be other documents such as opinions that are sent over. There may be interest rate swap agreements. There may be asset swap agreements. Depends on the structure and the way it's going to work. So these are multiple documents that the analysts are looking at as they come through. Even when they send over an indenture, which is for a cash CDO, the main document, there are a lot of brackets. So you can have a document, but you know where it says the average rating will be X. And it just has brackets. So some of the most important things are typically bracketed from the beginning. And so as the analysis goes on, more of those brackets are filled in, and those are things that we first compare to see whether the information that they had given us in the term sheets or through the models or through the discussions matches what is now showing up in the documentation. And also we're looking to see whether the deal the waterfall, for example, in a cash flow deal, works in the way that the term sheet represents that it should work, that the calculations are that they work the way that they should work, that the look to see what the covenants are in the transaction, the type of assets that the manager is able to invest in, under what terms that they can trade, buy and sell the assets. The dates within the transaction for when payments are due or when calculations are made or when tests are run. All that information would be contained in the documentation, but it's not all necessarily there on the first draft of the transaction, on the documentation. So that's something that comes over time. As I mentioned before, the documentation for the purely synthetic deals tends to be a little bit slimmer in size, but the importance of the information is a little bit denser because all the information, most of the really pertinent information is contained in the confirm. A lot of the master agreements, for example, tend to be pretty standardized. A lot of it is under is the templates, so it's relatively standardized. A lot of the programs, for example, I mentioned structured note programs, tend to have a base document that's used for multiple issuances. That's not something that typically changes over time. It's usually the individual note prospectuses. And so depending on what the transaction is, the documentation that is required to in terms of the operation of that transaction will be different. And the analysts are reviewing the documentation as it comes in and comparing it to what they already been told as well as what the model is doing.
So when are things run through the model? Mm-hmm. So you have, let's just sort of break down the steps, mm-hmm. and then let's talk about what's in the steps.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we've talked about managing director gets called,
mm-hmm.
analyst assigned,
mm-hmm.
term sheet arrives, documentation. You mentioned two committees.
At least
two committees. When are things run through the model? Are they run through the model at when the term sheet comes over, or when the other documentation comes over, or what?
Let's step back in terms of mm-hmm. what you're calling a model.
Okay.
We have different methodologies for different types of transactions. For this, it would be very different for a static transaction where the underlying pool of collateral is known on day one versus a managed deal where we're writing to the covenants of what the portfolio is allowed to be.
Mm-hmm.
The static transactions, we tend to look at using a Monte Carlo simulation approach,
mm-hmm.
which incorporated a model that we have called CRM.
Mm-hmm.
That is a model that is on our website. People can download it once they've signed the mm-hmm. licensing agreement. We always only have the latest version on the website,
mm-hmm.
and the licensing agreement requires that any user of it always use the latest version.
Mm-hmm.
And
so when do you start putting things into mm-hmm. CDO-ROM? Is it at the term sheet level or at the documentation level?
Well, CDO-ROM basically takes a pool of assets
mm-hmm.
and a liability structure. So once we have the information about what the pool of assets are and what the liability structure is, then that information can be run through CDO-ROM.
So it could be at the term sheet stage?
It could be at the term sheet stage if they provide us with the pool and with the liability structure.
Okay. And let's make things easy. Static deal.
Mm-hmm.
So not a managed deal. So. And where then in the chronology mm-hmm. do you have your first rating committee meeting?
When the analysts are ready for that first rating committee meeting, it's a lot of times things are changing, meaning the liability structure may be changing, the assets in the portfolio could be changing based upon discussions that the bank is having with the investors. A lot of the synthetic transactions tended to be reverse inquiry type transactions from one investor with doing a deal with the bank. So in that case, I'm talking about a static synthetic transaction. Typically,
does the first committee meeting happen after you've received the documentation or before?
It could be before.
Is there typical, or you say it could be? Is it typically after, typically before, or
there's no typical.
Okay.
I mean, it depends on what it is that. So if we're being asked to take a look at the portfolio and make a decision as to if this is what the final portfolio looks like, if this is what the final liability structure looks like, assuming that you have no issues with the documentation, could you let us know what your view is of where the rating could come out? So there's a lot of ifs in that, and so that may be something that we run through It may not necessarily be a committee. It may just be a meeting of those people, because we're not voting on a rating in this case. Mm-hmm. But it's something that anybody involved in the transaction, the analyst, the committee chair, or the MD, may want to know in terms of what's been going on. And then we would have a discussion with the bankers. Okay, given all these caveats that you just mentioned, here's what we see, and this is the model. This is the model applied rating. Once we get the documentation, then we would have a further discussion about the documentation, and the analysts would be comparing what they have in the portfolio and then the liability structure to what's in the document.
Documentation. And what is a pricing committee meeting?
Typically, it's called a pre-pricing committee. Typically, mm-hmm. in a deal, there's a point at which the deal pricing is set, the liability pricing is set, and it's typically, I think, when the offering circular is essentially made official, and so a lot of times we will have a committee, and it's not always the case. If we don't feel we have enough information to have a committee, if they're not ready for it, we've told people, look, it's your own risk. If you go in price and we find something that we're saying that we don't feel comfortable with, then that's your own risk. At the same time, if we have a committee based upon the information that you provided to us at that point, but you go and change something material, or this material to the rating, then the rating can change as well. So the pre-pricing committee typically happens before the bank goes out and really sets all the terms of the transaction. And
is the output from the pre-pricing committee meeting, mm-hmm. the output is ratings on the structure?
The output is what we believe the ratings will be. We don't assign a rating at that time.
And is that communicated to the bank?
At that time, we will communicate to them. Typically, they have target ratings that they want mm-hmm. to have on each individual. Typically, what's communicated to them at that point is that there are any issues that have arisen that would prevent us from being able to get to their target ratings.
Okay.
So we don't give them ratings. We basically understand where they're trying to get to and explain to them if there are any issues that we foresee, given what they've given us to date, assuming that nothing changes with what we have so far.
And then after the pre-pricing committee meeting, mm-hmm. When is the final committee meeting?
It's typically a day or two before the closing of the transaction.
And information from your pre-pricing committee meeting mm-hmm. would be conveyed to the bank, but it wouldn't be conveyed publicly. Is that correct?
That's right, because we're not announcing a rating. We're discussing issues that could come up in the analysis that will, could prevent us from getting to a specific rating that they're looking for.
And for a static pool CDO, mm-hmm. A cash CDO,
there aren't many static pool cash CDOs.
Okay, then let's take a make things easier than a static pool synthetic CDO.
Okay.
What were the rules as far as substituting out collateral or the reference collateral? What were the rules for that?
If it was truly static, mm-hmm. then the pool would be set at closing, and there would be no changes. So I'm not sure what you mean mm-hmm. by rules.
In other words, you have the pre-pricing committee meeting.
Mm-hmm.
With one particular structure in mind,
mm-hmm.
How much can that structure change between the pre-pricing committee mm-hmm. meeting and your final rating committee meeting? How much can that structure change and vary without the rating change? Are there any particular rules for that?
There's no rating assigned mm-hmm. at the pre-pricing committee. Issues are raised that could prevent us from getting to a target rating. So we would raise the issues that we foresee. It's understood that the structures, the portfolios, everything can change up until closing. And so at that point, the feedback that's given is, assuming that nothing changes, then this is, we don't foresee any issues, or here are the issues that we do foresee as being problematic. and as a committee decision. Now, a lot of those issues were probably already raised by the analysts and as part of the discussion, because that's something that would typically be raised. But there could be other issues that are identified in the course of the committee through the question and answer process.
And could collateral be substituted out for other collateral?
Substituted
during the rating process?
Substituted assumes that there is already a set collateral. Nothing's set until the closing. So what they're providing us is what they believe the final portfolio to be, and that's something that we're looking at until the final rating committee. Mm-hmm. So the portfolio that we look at the pre-pricing committee, that could change, and we all know that it could change. And the feedback, as I mentioned, is assuming that nothing changes. Now, nothing may change, or it could change, but that's not a substitution. That's basically them still structuring and creating the transaction. Mm-hmm. That process can go up until the point at which we actually assign the rating.
And I've heard something about an appeals process mm-hmm. from a rating. Mm-hmm. What was the appeals process? When did that occur? Typically in the chronology, did it come after the final rating, or did it come after the pre-pricing committee? When does the appeals process occur?
You can only appeal a rating that is already in existence, meaning that it's been voted on. Mm-hmm. There can be two different types of appeals, and this is in our policies. An external appeal, meaning the appeal comes from some external party; internal appeal, which is somebody internally raises an appeal on a rating. In both cases, it's after the rating is already voted on. So in one case, the external appeal would be that there is some new information that some of the external appeals that we did not know about or that we did not take into account, and they're asking us to take that into account in the rating. So they're raising that. It has to be new information that was not considered. On the internal side, there's no specified set of rules in terms of what someone can use to appeal or not to appeal. So if you don't agree with the rating, and typically it's not just that someone just doesn't agree with the rating that was assigned, it's because they feel that XYZ was not considered in the rating process, or they feel that something was not discussed enough in the rating process. Those would be the typical types of things. Or, we just found out some information about some changes that we expect. And so those are the types of things that internal appeals may come from. It can come from in somebody who's part of the committee. It could come from somebody who's not part of the committee. The process after that appeal is raised is then the committee chair would discuss with the analyst, and they would make a decision as to whether, for example, the external information is really material and that there should be an appeal. They would listen to the rationale given by the person that's raising the appeal internally as to why they think there should be appeal. If they think, no, that that's something that was discussed, that was something that was taken into account, they may say no, they may say yes. Typically, it's raised then to the next senior level. And we may include more people for the rating committee from either people that are familiar with specific issues that are being raised by the appeal, but it's an expanded rating committee.
And you said more senior person, would that be then the group managing director?
Well, it depends on who the committee chair was. If the committee chair was an SVP, it could be the MD at that point. So it's really whoever is the committee chair would raise it to their supervisor.
How often did the appeals process occur? Is this 1 in 10 deals, 1 in 20, 1 in 100? I mean, what was the frequency of this appeals process?
It wasn't that something that was used very often. I'd be making a guess as to what it was in any instance that I was. That I'd be raising it. Yeah, I don't even know what the number was. It could happen in a surveillance committee. It could happen in a New Deal setting.
But let's just focus on the New Deals that you were familiar with. Mm-hmm. The New Deal rating process, was that more frequently than 1 in 10? Less frequently than 1 in 10?
Less frequently.
Less frequently than 1 in 10. Less frequently than 1 in 50.
That I don't know. I don't know what the numbers were. It wasn't a frequent occurrence.
Okay.
You would ask this in the context of the rating process.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned that an appeal would only occur after the rating is assigned or the rating is voted on.
Mm-hmm.
Any issues that are brought up in the rating process, that's just part of the rating process. So to the extent that we have a pre-pricing committee and there may be discussions within there, and often there were discussions and differences of opinion, that was the whole purpose of the committee. So those are the types of things that were vetted, but it wouldn't necessarily be an appeal. You would be listening to what the other analysts had to say, and to the extent somebody had a strong objection to a provision or the way in which something may have been modeled or looked at, that's something that would be something that would need to be considered by the analysts and the deal team.
Was there a rule as to the minimum number of persons on a rating committee?
I can't remember if there was a specific rule. There were rules as to who could be committee chair. I don't remember if there was a rule in terms of the minimum number of people.
The rating that occurred at the time of closing,
mm-hmm.
would that rating be made public at the same time it was conveyed to the bank? Or was that conveyed to the bank and the bank was given an opportunity to then appeal it?
Typically, the rating, we're in constant communication with the bank along the road of the rating analysis. And so if there are issues that are coming up prior to the committee that could be issues, that's being communicated to them along the way. When we have the committee, there would still be issues that come out of the final rating committee. And essentially, we'd be going back to the bank and saying, okay, either we did not take a vote at this time because something needed to be resolved, or we took a vote, but it was subject to this issue. So there would be communication with the bank after the rating committee for a new deal.
And prior to being made public?
And prior to being made public.
Okay. When is the rating made public then? What's the trigger for making the rating public?
When the deal closes.
Okay. So a few days before closing, you have the rating committee.
Mm-hmm.
You have the final vote. You have a vote of the committee.
Mm-hmm.
The rating then is communicated to the bank at that point?
Typically, it's yes, the ratings are as you had targeted, or we were not able to get to the ratings that you targeted, and therefore it's this rating. So, yes, that information is conveyed to the bank after the committee.
And then it's ultimately conveyed to the public at the time of closing?
Right, through a press release as well as our rating letter as part of the closing documents.
Okay. In this time period after you've voted,
mm-hmm.
a couple days before the closing,
mm-hmm.
on the rating,
mm-hmm.
and if you communicated that to the bank,
mm-hmm.
were there ever instances where the rating committee reconvened again and decided on a different rating prior to closing?
There have been instances where the bank has come back and made some changes and therefore required a reconvening of a rating committee to discuss those changes and to vote again as to whether the rating is still held or not.
Were there ever instances where the bank didn't make any substantive changes to the structure but just complained about the rating, said, you got this wrong, rating committee, you need to think about this again, and your rating's off? Did that ever occur? And where
have
you
they complained? Yes. The appeal process, though, is very explicit. It has to be new information that's provided that was not considered by that rating committee. To the extent that they said, they would come back and say, well, did you consider this? This is information that you did that, oh, by the way, we didn't provide you. Maybe you should think about this. Then we would make a decision as to whether we thought that that would be a material, have a material impact, and we could convene again to take that into account.
Did it ever occur where after the rating committee meets,
mm-hmm.
conveys the rating to the bank,
mm-hmm.
the bank says, you just got it wrong,
mm-hmm.
go back and reconvene, and the same rating committee reconvened
mm-hmm.
and came up with a different rating? Did that ever happen?
I can't think of an instance where that happened without any new information that was provided, just because someone disagreed.
We've heard instances of Moody's employees that have left to go work for banks.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me about any, do you recall any Moody's employees that were leaving to go work for an investment bank?
Yes.
Okay. We talked earlier about the pressure of investment banks,
mm-hmm.
timing, threats to take away business, but were there any ways that investment banks tried to game the modeling process?
Mm-hmm.
Any ways that they tried to manipulate the ratings or try to game the process to get a higher rating?
I wouldn't call it just gaming. Basically, each deal was structured slightly differently, and to I would assume maximize the return for the risk for the various stakeholders within the transaction. So the bankers would create structural features. They would structure the transaction in a way to achieve that end result. Our job as analysts was to understand what those features were, how they worked, and how they could change the credit of the transaction and the impact on the ratings. We started talking before about models. We talked about the CD-ROM model as the kind of the synthetic model. On the cash flow side, we had a methodology, not really a model. We didn't have a model tool that we just fed numbers into. We have a methodology that we published on, which is we have a couple of methodologies. One being the binomial, the other being correlated binomial, which is another version of the binomial that allows us to look at asset classes like RMBS that are more correlated than a typical corporate portfolio. And that methodology is something that is, I think, pretty well known in the market. It can be something that's implemented in a spreadsheet. So it's a methodology of looking at the risk of a pool, of looking at the potential distribution of losses of how the cash flows work. The tool that I was talking about that Gus's group was working on is a cash flow modeling tool. It allows the analyst to code in how interest and principal cash flows are paid. And it's a tool that can be, basically makes things faster than doing it in Excel. So once again, there are Excel models that can do the same thing, and then there's this tool that's coded in a programming language that allows things to move faster. So when we say model for a cash flow deal, there isn't a specific model that we have that we just pull out and we plug numbers into. Each deal has to be coded up based upon the specifics of that transaction, the features that are in it, the way the cash flows work. The methodology behind it is in how we look at the portfolios and construct the model portfolios based upon the covenants in the deal, and how we, the methodology is to take the specifics of the transaction into account in modeling the cash flows that come off that pool. So there's not, I felt like that you had a view that there was a model that basically the quantitative analyst just goes and, you know, puts numbers into, and then, voila, you have an answer as to what the rating should be, and that's essentially the answer.
On the CDO side, let's take synthetic CDOs.
Mm-hmm.
How did banks,
mm-hmm.
how were they able to structure their deals? Were they able to structure their deals in a way
mm-hmm.
to in effect manipulate the process? I use the word game, but let me tell you the basis for my question. We've heard allegations about investment banks because the model was essentially available, and because they had worked with rating agencies for over the years,
mm-hmm.
that they knew just how to structure deals in order to get the most rating possible, but perhaps a rating that you might not agree with. So when I say the word game, I mean manipulate the process to get a higher rating than perhaps they deserved, that Moody's would agree with. And you would see this and say, wait a second here, no. This isn't the rating. We wouldn't agree with this rating. Perhaps at the pre-pricing decision where someone says, here's what we think the ratings are going to be for the structure. And you say, oh, no. That tranche is not AA or AAA, or that expected loss is off, or whatever it is, because in your analysis came out differently, and their analysis was done in a way perhaps to manipulate the ratings to have a more favorable rating.
Mm-hmm.
So not a situation, I mean, obviously they want to structure the deal in a way that gets them mm-hmm. a rating outcome that they envision.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm talking about a way where they try to game or manipulate the process.
Mm-hmm.
Did that occur where they were trying to game, they, meaning the banks, try to game or manipulate the actual process?
Let me just clarify on a couple of things that you said.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned before that the structures may have a target rating in mind that
mm-hmm.
they would like to achieve, but they weren't the ones saying this is what the rating should be or this is what the rating is. I don't know
okay.
if that's what you meant before when you were saying that, but it's only we're making the decision as to what the rating should be in our committees based upon the analysis of the structure.
Let's just take the question then. Forget
okay.
the predicate.
Okay. The
did any banks try to game or manipulate mm-hmm. the rating process? And if so, how did they do it?
I can't think of an instance where it was something that was outside of the process and they're trying to game the process. Often we would model the transaction as we understood it from the first from their explanation, but also in comparing how we model the transaction compared to the documentation. Quite often, if we came up with different results than what they may have modeled, because I mentioned in some cases the banks would also model up the transactions in their own models.
Mm-hmm.
We could do a check as to what the assumptions are that they've put into their models versus what we've put into our models. And a lot of the discussion and disagreements with the bank happened to have been about the assumptions that were made. So when did you assume that defaults happened within the pool? Did you assume that they happened in the beginning of the period, at the end of the period? What did you assume the amortization schedules to look like? Well, we tested these various amortization schedules, and we don't think that that's necessarily the most conservative or the most accurate in terms of what we think could happen. Those were the discussions we had. Now, if you think about the the fact that they're providing us with their own modeling of the transaction, and they're saying, ha-ha, we came up with, you know, what we think that you're going to rate this at. And, you know, if you, I don't think of that as necessarily gaming. It's their interpretation of how they think that our analysis would be applied. We're basically looking at it and saying, no, this is not the way we would assume it. We, you know, where are we different? You know, what are the differences in assumptions? Why are we coming up with different answers? And to the extent that we can identify those issues, then that would be, that's kind of where we would have the discussion as to, look, we don't agree with the assumptions that we're making. This is the assumptions that I think we should make, and something that we're going to discuss in committee.
Did you ever feel at any time that a bank misrepresented any information to you during the rating process?
The ratings are not based upon what the bankers represented to us or told us. I mean, the ratings were based on the governing documentation of the transaction. To the extent that the governing transaction, the documents of the transaction, do not represent how the deal worked, that would be a problem. I cannot think of a case where that's the case. So there may be times where a banker would say, oh, this is just like the other deal, there's no differences. You know, that may be their view, that's not necessarily our view. But we're not going to take their word for it. It's something that we need to confirm with the information that we have on the documentation.
What was the subprime working group or the subprime task force?
The subprime working group was a name that was used for a weekly meeting that was held starting in sometime in 2007, I believe. I'm not sure exactly when. The people that were part of the subprime working group included the most senior people at Moody's, including Ray, Brian, since then Michelle.
Michelle who?
Michelle Medlin. And basically anybody at the, I think, GMD level and above were invited.
Were you a member of the subprime working group?
It wasn't like a committee or something where you were a member of it. It was a distribution list.
Were you on the distribution
list? I was on the distribution list.
And did you regularly attend the meetings?
Not always.
Okay. How often did you attend the meetings?
There were basically people there that would be there to provide information, and then others there that would be there to hear information. Quite often, I would be asked to provide information about what's going on in the CDO group, CDO ratings, what's going on in terms of our analysis. And so I attended quite often for the beginning because I was there to provide this information. It's still a meeting that occurs now, but it's not called the Subprime Working Group anymore. It's called the Global Coordination Group. It became a forum for an exchange of information among the most senior people in the company as to what was going on in the various areas. It started out as being called the Subprime Working Group because that was the point of discussion at the beginning.
In 2007, mm-hmm. you said these meetings occurred approximately once a week?
Yes.
Okay. And in 2007, mm-hmm. did you attend over 50% of the meetings, over 75% of the meetings, 25% of the meetings, 10% of the meetings? Rough estimate, what percentage of the meetings do you attend?
Rough estimate, probably about 75 or more.
Okay. And during these subprime working group meetings, mm-hmm. did you talk about potential downgrades of RMBS? Did you talk about the possibility of downgrading RMBS?
Yes.
Okay. And how early in 2007 do you recall discussions concerning downgrading of RMBS?
I actually don't remember when the subprime working group meeting started.
Okay. When you said they started sometime in 2007.
That's my guess. I don't know when.
Okay. And you were on the distribution list from the start of the group?
I don't know if I was on it from the beginning.
Okay. if you remember going to any of the meetings where someone said, this is the first meeting of the subprime working group. Do you have any sense of if you were attending from the start?
If not the very first meeting, I was definitely there toward the beginning of the meetings. It wasn't necessarily called the subprime working group.
Okay.
It was a meeting of senior management to discuss, and so that everybody understood what was going on in the RMBS and CDO areas.
Okay. How early into your attendance to these meetings do you recall there being discussions of downgrades on the horizon of RMBS?
I don't know. I don't recall.
Did Mr. Clarkson attend these meetings?
He did attend, not all.
And what was his attendance like, approximately? Was he at every meeting where you attended?
I don't think so. I remember there were meetings where he wasn't at, other meetings where he may come in for a little bit and leave. Same thing with myself. If I was basically being asked information, I may provide information and leave. So people weren't necessarily there for the entire meeting.
Did you ever discuss during any of these subprime working group meetings mm-hmm. the implications of RMBS downgrades on the CDOs that you and your team were responsible for rating?
Did we as a group? Yes, mm-hmm. we discussed.
Okay. And what do you remember discussing about the effects of downgrades, RMBS downgrades, mm-hmm. on the CDOs that your team was responsible for rating?
The earliest recollection that I have is in the kind of the first part of 2007, leading up to the paper that we wrote in March of 2007. On the potential impact of rating downgrades. I remember discussing with the subprime working group that we were putting that paper together and that to let them know what some of the analysis was that we were doing as well as what some of the results were of that analysis, essentially what was going to go into the paper.
And were there ever any discussions at all that you were privy to about not rating CDOs, ABS CDOs, during the process where you were contemplating downgrades?
I don't remember that ever being a discussion topic at the Supreme Court.
Showing you what's mm-hmm. been marked Exhibit 9, an email that was produced to us. It's a series of emails, rather. The first email is from Eric Kolchinski to you and Noel Kernan, dated June 19, 2007. There's a response from you on June 20th to Eric Kolchinski and Yvonne Fu. There's a response by Yvonne Fu to you and Eric Kolchinski, and then there's a response at the top from you to Yvonne Fu and Eric Kolchinski. Dated June 20th, 2007. The subject of these are BSAM updates. And BSAM is Bear Stearns Asset Management, is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. At the bottom, there's an email from Mr. Kolchinski to you that says, as per Yuri's request, I wanted to give you an update on the BSAM situation. One of their leverage funds has been undergoing a messy liquidation. Last week, this fund sold approximately $4 billion of RMBS, and you can read the rest of that email. Do you remember asking Mr. Kolchinski to look into the BSAM situation?
Let me just read that.
Sure, please. Yeah. Thank you.
I remember asking Eric to put together this email. I don't remember how that request came about. I don't remember if, I don't remember if I went to him and said, asked him to look into it and then to write me an email, or if he came in to talk to me about, you know, what he saw, and then I asked him to basically put it into an email so that I could inform Noel. Mm-hmm. I don't remember.
And so you have no recollection of the reason why you asked Mr. Polchinski?
I don't remember the order in which things happened. The reason why I do remember that the information was, we were trying to get information about what was going on with Bear Stearns asset management, and so to the extent that we had some views, I wanted to make sure that it was known within the company.
Why were you trying to get information about Bear Stearns asset management?
Because it was something that was in the news. Quite often when you do have things that are in the news about what's going on in the CDO area or an area that's under our responsibility, we'll get questions. I wanted to get ahead of that and basically get information to my manager about what was going on in the market.
Who was your manager?
No.
Okay. You respond to his email and thank him and ask Mr. Kolchinski and Ms. Fu to touch base with their contacts at various banks to get more feedback of what was going on. Mm-hmm. And you see that? And that was on the 20th, and on June 20th as well, Ms. Fu responds and talks about how she had already asked Rodrigo and Borja?
It's a misspelling. It's Puja.
Okay. Who's Rodrigo and Puja?
They're both analysts within the group.
Okay. It says Bill and Rick are in frequent contact with their CDPC. Who do you understand her to mean by Bill and Rick?
I think Bill Harrington and Rick Michalik.
Michalik?
Yes.
Okay. There's a reference here to Felicia. Do you understand who?
Felicia Grumet. I believe she was working at BSAM. BSAM was in the process of asking us to rate a credit derivative product company, a CDPC. And so we wanted to understand what this impact could. One of the things that we wanted to know is what impact this could have on that CDPC, whether it was something they would move forward with or not. And so we were trying to get information from him, from her. So.
At the top of this email, you respond and say, thanks, I'm now getting calls from Linda Huber mm-hmm. and Ray asking for information about what's going on on with the market generally and our pipeline prospects. Obviously, they're getting calls from analysts and investors. Mm-hmm. First, let's take these names. Who is Linda Huber?
She's the CFO.
CFO of Moody's?
Yes.
And who is Ray McDaniels?
He's the CEO.
Sorry, McDaniel, right? No,
yes.
No S. Sorry. He's the CEO. Okay. What did you mean by our pipeline prospects?
In terms of what was going on in terms of the market with BSAM and the news that we were hearing, it was, if I remember at this time, there was a lot in the paper about BSAM and about Bear Stearns.
What did you mean by our pipeline prospect?
In terms of what do we see in terms of the transactions or the potential deals that we could see, for example, the CDPC that had been that we had started to look at, other implications of the what was going on in the market at that time, in relation to what types of deals that we would see going forward. So the pipeline of deals.
In other words, your business pipeline.
Business pipeline, yes.
Okay. And
the analysts and investors that I'm talking about here are analysts who look at Moody's and investors of Moody's.
Investors of Moody's. So Ms. Huber and Mr. McDaniel mm-hmm. were asking questions about the business implications to Moody's mm-hmm. of the BSAM funds and their situation that Mr. Polchinski described.
Yes.
He said, I forwarded them Eric's email below and told them that we would let them know what we hear about the potential fire sale and any effects on the market. What do you mean by fire sale? Referring to that?
I think I was referring to what Eric was talking about within his own email at the bottom. He was talking about the fact that one of BSAM's funds was selling RMBS. Also, we had heard about liquidating of collateral by repo counterparties, some of that collateral being CDO collateral. And essentially, there are certain triggers on the repos that when they hit those triggers that they have to sell collateral. So it's that's what I meant by fire sale, that there would be a forced sale of a number of CDOs.
I'd like to show you what's marked in Exhibit 10. And Exhibit 10 is a document base numbered Moody's-COGR 0067972 through 975. And the series of emails beginning with an email from Ted Collins to the Moody's Subprime Working Group dated September 4th, 2007. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Copying.
Yes.
And who did you say Ted Collins was?
Ted Collins was a group managing director at that time, responsible for various parts of financial institutions, including financial guarantors.
Okay. Any copies? Stanislas Royer?
Stanislas
Royer. And who is... Is that Mr.?
Mr.
Mr. Royer? Who's Mr. Royer?
He was a senior vice president. Oh, actually, I don't know if he was a senior vice president at that time. He was a senior analyst within the financial guarantor group.
Jack Doerr? Who's Jack Doerr?
I mentioned him before. He's a team MD for financial guarantors.
I believe you mentioned Laura Levenstein. She was in the financial guarantors group as well.
I think her position at that time was senior managing director responsible for financial institutions generally. I'm not completely positive on her title.
Okay. He says in his email to the subprime working group, first of all, did you receive this email? Do you know?
I probably did. I'm pretty sure that I was probably part of that distribution group.
At some point you reply to it on page 67972. Does that refresh your recollection if you received it?
I don't remember the specific email, but I'm pretty sure that I was part of the distribution group, so I think it's pretty safe to say that I was on the distribution.
Okay. And a series of emails concerning a financial guarantor special comment. What was that?
Let me just read this. From what I'm reading here, I know that the financial guarantors group put out various reports and press releases about their views of the impact of the financial crisis on financial guarantors. I don't know whether this was a first or one of where it fell in terms of the reports that they put out, but I don't remember the report specifically. I just remember that they did put out reports on the impact.
Was this report relevant to you and the CDO business?
It wasn't relevant to... It was relevant in that, as I mentioned before, the financial guarantor group was users of other groups' ratings. And so the information that we had on CDOs was vital to their analysis, just as the information on RMBS was also vital to theirs as well as to ours.
Okay.
I'm sorry, let me read the...
I'd like to...
I'm going to just read the whole... Wait to change.
Thank you. I have a question about a few things. First of all, your comment on the email on the front page, your email dated September 5th, 2007, said, say, in the first bullet, I'd like to make sure that we don't publish or say anything at the teleconference that will lead people to the conclusion that losses on AAAs will be widespread. I believe that as it stands, the information in the paper is oversimplified and could easily lead people to this conclusion. Why did you not want anything published or said that would lead people to the conclusion that losses on AAA would be widespread?
Because it wasn't something that we believed at the time.
Were losses on AAA subsequently widespread?
Definitely. There are a lot more losses on AAA than we would have expected or would like, yes.
Is that yes?
Yes, there are a lot of losses on AAA.
Widespread losses.
I don't know if there are, well, two things. Again, at this time, we did not, it was not something that, in our view, was going to happen. And my biggest concern, as I'm expressing throughout this, is leaving people with the wrong impression compared to what we thought internally was happening at the time.
But the impression that you thought was wrong turned out to be correct. Is that true?
The impression that I thought was wrong turned out to be correct, but not for the reasons that were stated in this paper. A lot of the AAA losses have come because of liquidations, not because of collateral losses in the pools.
Collateral losses didn't lead to losses on the AAA?
I don't know of cases at this point where the AAAs have actually taken losses because of collateral losses in the underlying pools. I don't know the numbers. I don't think it's widespread. A lot of the losses have been taken because of liquidations.
Okay.
My concern in this was that the information that was provided could lead to conclusions that were not necessarily what we believed, and that it wasn't clear in terms of how the losses on the underlying mortgages could lead to losses in the CDOs.
So you were disagreeing with Mr. Collins and his group's assessment. Is that fair?
No. I was disagreeing with the way in which it was positioned because I thought that it could be misleading.
You say, my primary comments on the second page, if we haven't published the 10% number, I think that putting it out as the base case is dangerous, given that our own RMBS group is saying that the worst quartile will percent experience a 9 to 16% cumulative loss.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Well, as I go on to say, We're trying to tell the market that you can't paint everything with a broad brush, that one number does not describe what we expect experience to be of all the various tranches. At that time, the RMBS group had been breaking the issuers and transactions into various quartiles of what they thought the losses could be, and it would depend on the specific transactions, the specific mortgage collateral that was in there, the issuers, et cetera, but there were many things that could determine what the end outcome could be in terms of the cumulative loss for any specific transaction. And so the concern is that by putting out one number, when our RMBS group is saying it's not one number, it could be differentiated depending on what part of the market or what collateral is in these pools. I thought that it was a concern to just put one number out there because it would be misleading.
You also say, I'd prefer to leave out the typical ABS CDO enhancement levels.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Because I thought, once again, that it could be misleading to talk about typical ABS CDO enhancements when we're talking about a paper on monolines and their investments. And the monolines were not necessarily involved in typical typical tranches. They're not involved in the typical AAA, but there were some differences in the types of deals that they were involved in.
You say we, again, we have not yet put out a public statement on where we thought the AAA and AA CDO tranches will end up, and would prefer that people not make up their own minds based on a simplified analysis.
Right, because we were still doing our own analysis about where we thought the losses could end up and how individual transactions would be affected. The main message that we were trying to put out at that time, which I've mentioned a couple times here, is that it's very much deal and collateral specific, and that the concern was that we were putting out something that is broad brush and would be misinterpreted to be something that would be applied to all the different transactions out there. And so the people would essentially not consider all the issues that we were mentioning that could affect an individual transaction having different performance one to the next.
When did you put out guidance on where the AAA and AA CDO tranches would end up?
I don't know when we specifically put that out.
Because you said you preferred that you were still doing your own analysis. How long after this did you put out your own analysis?
We put out information to the extent that we knew it. I think we were not doing a batch run of CDOs. I mentioned before that each CDO is different. We have to take into account the uniqueness of each transaction as well as take into account the managed nature, the collateral, how it's changing. There are many things that we had to take into account for each individual transaction, and we were putting out ratings as we completed rating analysis on that transaction. So we continually updated the market in terms of what we were seeing in terms of the deals that we had been reviewing, but we did not necessarily have a view at this time, I can't think of a time where we put out something that said that we expect X percent of AAAs to either take a loss or not take a loss or have a certain level of downgrades. We put out analysis that showed that if a transaction had a certain amount of subprime and if the underlying subprime were downgraded by a number of tranches, this is where the ratings could end up. But the point that we're trying to make is that we had to review each transaction on its own portfolio, its own specifics, and so that we could not, once again, take a broad brush and paint the entire market for RMBS or CDOs to say this is how we expect them to work.
Was the impact on financial guarantors of the deterioration in the subprime market, was that impact on the financial guarantors relevant to the CDO business?
The impact on the, I'm sorry, when you say business, are you talking about the ratings or transaction volume?
Well, let's talk ratings. Okay. What would it mean for financial guarantors to be downgraded? What would that mean as far as the ratings of CDOs?
For CDOs that have exposure to individual financial guarantors, that would mean that there would be a downgrade within a portfolio if it was a portfolio asset, or if it was if it provided additional support in the way of a wrap, financial wrap on a transaction that we rated. Then it could have an impact on the ratings of that.
And it would be a negative impact of the ratings.
It would be a negative, not always. It would be a negative impact on the analysis, but one name or two names being downgraded doesn't necessarily mean that there would be a ratings impact.
Would it have in any way a positive impact on the ratings if a financial guarantor which had a wrap on any of these tranches were downgraded? Would it have a positive impact in any way?
No.
Okay. But it could have a negative impact.
It could have a negative impact.
And in fact, it could have a significant negative impact depending on the amount of involvement of a financial guarantor in a particular CDO structure. Isn't that true?
That is true.
And so if a financial guarantor were downgraded, that would be something that you would need to take into consideration when rating a CDO that had involvement of a financial guarantor in some of the tranches. Is that true?
That is true. Okay.
Going back to your email, you...
Just to be clear, we're talking about communication from the special comment here. We're not talking about what assumptions are being used to rate or to surveil financial guarantors.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good point, and I appreciate that. Based on this comment, what actions did you take with respect to changes to your ratings or rating methodology with respect to financial guarantors that had been guaranteeing tranches of the CDOs?
We, based upon the comment, we did not necessarily take action because the comment does not speak to where we expect the ratings of the financial guarantors to go. Based upon the information coming out of the financial guarantor committees and the discussions on the methodology to be used to surveil those financial guarantors, that information was used within the analysis that we did. So to the extent that one of the financial guarantors were downgraded, that's something that would flow into the analysis that we did.
When was the analysis changed due to the health of a financial guarantor? AMBAC, MBIA. When was the analysis changed for CDOs?
It would depend on the type of CDO and the role the financial guarantor played in the transaction. Mm-hmm. To the extent that we had financial guarantees on a tranche of a CDO, the methodology was to pass through the rating of the financial guarantor to the rating of the pass-through bond. And therefore, if the financial guarantor were downgraded from, say, AAA to AA1, then the rating would automatically go from AAA to AA1.
Were any financial guarantors downgraded in 2007?
I don't remember what the dates were of the downgrades. I think so, but I can't remember what the dates were.
Okay. So would the assessment of... Mm-hmm. the financial guarantor, it would depend on the rating to the financial guarantor. Is that correct?
The way in which... I think you're misunderstanding. If you had a transaction that was wrapped by a financial guarantee, mm-hmm. the methodology was to pass through the rating of the financial guarantor to that instrument.
Right.
So if the assessment of the guarantor changed and the rating of that guarantor changed, then the rating of that wrapped instrument would also change.
And would there be an instance where the rating of the financial guarantor did not change, but the assessment of that wrap based on the health of the financial guarantor changed?
It would not change.
Okay.
That was the methodology was to, and we were very clear on that in terms of how that would work. There was a point, though, at which we changed our methodology such that the rating of that wrapped instrument would be the better of the rating on the financial guarantor and our assessment of the underlying risk of the underlying asset.
And when was that?
I don't remember when that was released.
What year?
I don't remember. It was, I think it was when Noel Kernan was still there, because I remember him being a part of some of those discussions, so that would have had to have been prior to his departure in summer of 2008, but I don't remember exactly when the changes were made. And so there could be a situation where the guarantor is downgraded to BAA, for example, but the asset, the underlying asset, has a standalone rating of AAA, and then the wrapped asset would then still remain AAA. That's one instance of a financial guarantor having involvement in the transaction. The other area that we had quite a bit of financial guarantor involvement, but where they came up a lot, was in synthetic CDOs.
Mm-hmm.
They tended to be the in corporate synthetic CDOs. They tended to be the one of the reference entities that were referenced by the synthetic CDOs. For those transactions, I don't remember if we made a specific change to how we looked at individual guarantors. I do remember there being discussions about stressing the ratings that were there in the analysis. Also, one of the things that we do is once a rating is put on review for downgrade, we automatically stress those. So we take them down by one or two notches, depending on.
When were the monolines placed on review for downgrade?
I don't remember.
In 2007, speaking not of corporate synthetics, but synthetics that are that involve a reference to mortgages or mortgage securities like RMBS, those synthetics in 2007, how often was there a monoline involved in the structure?
It wasn't very often that they were involved directly in the structure that we were writing. They could have, as I mentioned in my comments here, they may have gotten involved after the fact, as banks tended to do some credit default swaps with the financial guarantors to lay off their risk within the capital structure to the financial guarantors. But they may typically they weren't part of the primary deal that we were writing.
Mm-hmm. How often would they be involved in the I dare say secondary, but the secondary?
That's not something that we would know.
Okay. You say finally, I thought we agreed not to publish specific numbers with regards to the individual monolines.
Mm-hmm.
Did you prefer that specific numbers with regards to the individual monolines not be published? Was that your position?
Just read that paragraph again. As I mentioned in this paragraph, and once again, I was concerned with the way in which the information was positioned because I was worried that there would be an assumption on the part of the reader that that all or many super CDOs would experience losses up to and including the super senior, which I didn't think was an appropriate assumption given what we knew at that time.
Mm-hmm. And subsequently, have you learned that to be the case?
Once again, I don't know of specific losses on the super senior tranches coming from losses on the underlying pools. Liquidations have been the main source of losses, and typically with monolines, if they are the controlling party, they have more of an incentive not to liquidate.
On the second page of your email here, your concluding bullets, mm-hmm. You said, well, to begin with, that section starts with, "For tomorrow's teleconference, Ted asked me to put together what I thought should be the focus and what shouldn't. I would focus on," and you list the things to focus on. You say, "I would not focus on," and you have three things: specific loss assumptions at the mortgage, RMBS, and CDO level. Why did you not want them to focus on that?
Because the information that they were talking about was a very broad brush type approach. They were not presenting information that talked about the differentiation that we in the CDO group and the RMBS group had been discussing in our own papers and our own communications. So my concern was that if we put out a number or some broad brush number about the assumptions that we were making, that assumptions that we were making in the financial guarantor group, to kind of get a sense of what the impact could be, that it would be misleading because that's not necessarily what we're assuming in the analysis of the RMBS or the CDOs.
You could also say anything that can lead to a prediction on the losses for the underlying assets is another area you would not focus on.
Right, and that goes back to the content of the rest of the email, which is where people can take a guess at what they think that the losses are going to be, but it could be misleading information because they're not providing enough information for people to have an accurate view of what the underlying losses could be.
And you say anything that paints the market with one broad brush?
Same thing. My view was that they were being very broad brush about the information that they were putting out. They were putting it out in a very simple format, and my concern from from all the comments that I'm making here, including those, is that we don't put out information that is misleading.
Given the developments in the market subsequent to this email chain, did Mr. Collins's draft turn out to be correct in terms of the losses experienced by CDOs? Correct, but perhaps for the wrong reasons. Was it correct, though?
I don't know what the actual losses have been for the model lines from a credit point of view, so I don't know if it's correct or not. As I mentioned before, a lot of the model lines did not have incentive to liquidate, and to the extent that transactions have not liquidated, we have not seen losses at this point for the AAA tranches.
With respect to one broad brush, in hindsight, was it one broad brush that should have been applied?
I don't know. I don't know where the I haven't kept up with where the individual issuers were. My understanding is there are still issuers in the RMBS world that have worse experience than others, that there are vintages that have experienced worse losses than others and are expected to experience worse losses than others. So my understanding is that there still is differentiation despite the fact that the entire market has experienced deterioration. The severity of it is there is still some differentiation in the market.
Just have a few more, and then we'll wrap up here. Let me just ask you about some people that are on this. Excuse me?
2 minutes if we really can get to two.
Oh, you need to use a restroom.
Yes, I do.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I'm just wrapping up, and I don't want to. Sorry. We'll take a 2 minute. Everyone stay put except Sharon. Greg. We're back on record. It's 6:18. Ms. Yoshizawa, I'm handed to you what's remarked as Exhibit 11, which is Moody's COGR 0004719. I just have some questions about who some people are on this email. First, it's a series of emails again. Sorry, it's in front of you?
This one.
That email.
It's a different number?
11?
No.
10?
Sorry. Moody's COGR 0004710.
Yes. Mr.
Sorry, sorry. Oh, I apologize if I misspoke. 10 through 111. Sorry, Moody's COGR 0004719. Oh, excuse me, 10. It's getting late. 0004710 through 4711. Got it this time. Okay. First, if you could turn the page. The very first email on the string. There's an email from Lisa Westlake to you copying Brian Clarkson's and data request. Who is Lisa Westlake?
Lisa Westlake is, at this time, her responsibility was investor relations for Moody's Corporation. Investors in Moody's relations with them.
Mm-hmm. And our email is dated February 15th, 2007. She copies Brian Clarkson. Who is Brian Clarkson, and what position did he hold on February 15, 2007?
I'm not positive of the change in terms of when he became president, but I think at this time he was president of Moody's Investor Service.
Okay. She says in her email to you, copy of Mr. Clarkson, "Hi, Yuri, I've received multiple inquiries from sell-side analysts and the MCO investors regarding what percentage of our CDO revenue is RMBS based. And within that pool, what percentage is subprime? I don't need 100% accuracy, just directional indication. Do you have any way of coming up with those percentages?" First, what do you understand her to mean when she says sell-side analyst?
Analysts who follow Moody's Corporation.
Okay. And MCO investors, these are investors in Moody's Corporation stock.
Moody's Corporation.
Okay. And in response, you provide her with some information here. She said, if you look at our attached year-end review, and fortunately, the way I received this document didn't have the attachment. If you look at our attached year-end review, our resecuritization CDOs, which are essentially 100% RMBS-based, comprise approximately 47% by number and 62% by volume of the CDOs we rated in 2006. Resecuritization CDOs include resecs, synthetic resecs, and hybrids. So when you say 47% by number and 62% by volume of the CDOs we rated, mm-hmm. you mean all the CDOs you rated in 2006?
Yes.
Okay. So almost half of the CDOs in terms of numbers were RMBS based.
Yes.
Okay. 62% by the volume. And you say the subprime component may range from 50% to 100% of each deal. I'd guess about 75 to 80% on average. And you say, without the revenue information in front of me, I'd guess that the revenue breakdown would be in the same neighborhood. In other words, 50 to 60% RMBS based. That's 50 to 60% of all your CDO revenue was CDOs that had RMBS based collateral.
I was basing it on this number, the 40% to 60%, the 62%, the number and volume.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say at the bottom of your email, obviously, I can see where this line of questioning is going. Mm-hmm. Where was the line of questioning going?
My view was that people who were looking at Moody's, and including the sell-side analysts and the CEO investors, were looking at the potential impact of both the subprime crisis as well as the potential disappearance of ABS CDOs. And they wanted to know what the current impact is on revenue, so that they have a sense of what portion of our revenues were attributable to RMBS.
They want to know the impact to Moody's of mm-hmm. RMBS CDOs, or CDOs with RMBS collateral.
Of RMBS, and then also specifically subprime.
Okay. She responds to your email and copies Linda Huber.
Mm-hmm.
You said Linda Huber was the CFO?
That's right.
Okay. And on February 15th, 9:47 p.m., she says, "I haven't looked at the attachment yet, but this data answers the questions I've been getting regarding the percentage of CDOs that are RMBS. I'm not sure if we want to disclose, but if it's already in the year-end review, it's already out." She says, "Then at face value, it seems to paint a pretty dreary picture for future RMBS and CDOs of RMBS issuance if subprime continues to do poorly." The dreary picture she's describing there is a dreary picture in terms of Moody's business picture. Is that correct?
I'm not on this email, but I would assume that that's what she's talking about. But I don't want to put words in her mouth, but...
That would be your interpretation of it.
That would be my interpretation.
Okay. There's another phrase that I want to ask you about. Grandfathering. What is grandfathering?
I had mentioned before that grandfathering could be used in a variety of ways. In one of the earlier emails that you showed me, it was used by a banker who wanted us to continue to use in a new transaction an approach that we used to look at a risk in an earlier transaction. The idea, the concept behind grandfathering is to basically to continue to use something, whether it's an approach, a structure, feature, a methodology in looking at something new.
And then could grandfathering also apply to if you change the methodology?
Mm-hmm.
You're in the middle of the change, or you're contemplating a change, which methodology to apply?
It could also apply to that.
Okay. What were the rules or what in 2006 and 2007?
Mm-hmm.
I understand the rules may have changed, but what were the rules in 2006 and 2007, that time frame, for when an old methodology could be used versus a new methodology to be used? If there was a new methodology being contemplated, what were the rules there?
Often, a lot of this depends on, once again, what you mean by the word methodology. It's got a very broad usage. It could be something that is that we've made changes to methodology to account for, or we've refined methodologies to account for specific risks that are in new transactions, or it may be with respect to a provision or a mitigant that's being used. The idea behind the methodology changes, a lot of changes that we made and that we do make have to do with changes to parameters because of changes in the way we view the risk. To the extent that we make those changes should be applied to old transactions to the extent that that risk still applies, that risk is there in the old transaction. Sometimes we change methodology because we think we decide to move from one way of looking at transactions to another way of looking at transactions, which may or may not have a credit, underlying credit reason for that change. Quite often when we make that type of change, we do a lot of testing as we're developing methodology or refining methodology to understand what the impact could be on existing transactions. To the extent that there's a multiple notch impact, we want to understand why that's the case and whether we think that the new way of looking at it is more accurate way of looking at it. To the extent that the change is not because of a credit reason, not because we see a risk a different way, but it's because a change in kind of the way we've decided to use, for example, a Monte Carlo simulation as opposed to a binomial approach. They're both approximations. They're both ways of looking at risk. So we need to make a decision as to whether the new way is really telling us something about the credit risk. And so we are expected to have those type of discussions when we're talking about whether we use how do we use the new methodology. Quite often when we do that, next time we monitor those transactions, we typically look at both results.
I'll show you what's what Mark is exhibit 12.
Mm-hmm.
Our last exhibit of the day. Never end on an unlucky number like 13. Weirdly, I am superstitious. I got that from my dad, but anyway, I digress. Exhibit 12 is Bates numbered PSI, Moody's 000052 through 53. It was exhibit 91. of the exhibits that were released to the public of the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. And it's some email exchanges that you have with Eric Kolchinski and Yvonne Fu starting on May 22nd, 2007. And the last email is on this chain is May 23rd, 2007. The Ray line has subject line has paper on inter-CDO correlations update from ABS steering committee. First email is from Yvonne Fu to Eric Kolchinski and you on May 22nd. She says, I'm planning on sending this to the group. Please let me know if you're okay with it. Don't worry about spelling errors, as I'll do a spell check before sending. Eric, we did not talk about the one notch. Mr. Kolchinski responds on this one notch point, among others, and says, the one notch rule, I understand the impetus, but it may be problematic in the long term. I think that any stress levels that we implement now will be perceived by the market as being close to the final. They've been asking for certainty in their ability to ramp and structure deals. If we give a one-notch leeway with 2x now and end up with the 2x in the long term without the extra room, I think that bankers will be upset. Instead of dealing with the problem now, we will have to deal with it when we implement the final methodology. I think that we'd be better off doing 2.5x with one notch now and go to the 2x without. That way we can at least give them a trade-off. What's going on there? What is this discussion about the one notch? There's 2x, 2.5x. What do you understand Mr. Kolchinski to be conveying here? And I'll note that you reply to his email and say we need to find a way of positioning the one notch as our way of grandfathering. What is Mr. Kolchinski trying to convey, and what do you mean by your response about we need to find a way of positioning the one notch as our way of grandfathering?
First, as I mentioned before, deals were constantly evolving, and we needed to look at individual deals for the risks that they were presenting. What we start to see in middle of 2007 was that more and more deals were asking for either a basket, meaning the ability to buy other CDO tranches, or for static deals, we were seeing that they were putting in more CDOs into their transactions. And given that the synthetic nature of a lot of the deals that had been done allowed multiple deals to reference the same names, we had a concern that the CDOs that were going into CDOs were more correlated with each other than earlier vintage CDOs that had CDOs in them. And so we had formed a task force under Yvonne to start looking at that information. And as we were doing this, we were providing guidance to our committees and to our analysts that this is a concern, and that committees were asking analysts to run multiple scenarios stressing the correlations. This is something that's typical as we discover issues. Usually it happens on an ad hoc basis on an individual deal, and then we start seeing it in other deals. So then it becomes something that we decide that has to be part of a kind of more of a regular methodology, because it's something that we're seeing across deals, not just in individual deals here and there. The question was, how should we look at the correlation? The 2x and the 2.5x that are being discussed here are in relation to the existing inter-CDO correlations that we were using, and the question of what kind of multiple should we apply to those existing correlations based upon the types of overlap that we're seeing in the market.
And what does the greater multiple mean? What does 2.5 mean versus 2?
Meaning that if you had an asset correlation of some level, let's say 20%, I'm just coming up with a number, that 2 times would mean that we would look at 40%, 2.5 times would mean that we're looking at 50%, sorry.
Is this greater correlation?
Greater correlation than 2.5.
So the higher the number, if it was 2 times, 2.5 times mm-hmm. versus 2 times, the higher the correlation, the higher the number, the higher correlation.
Right.
Okay.
And so we were looking at various, levels of correlation, and the paper that we were putting out that Yvonne is talking about is a typically what we do when we update methodologies or we consider new methodologies or refinements of methodologies that could affect a number of transactions. We would put out a request for comment, basically saying, here's our analysis, here's what we are thinking about doing. At the same time, we were having discussions with market participants and about what our concerns are. Typically, request for comments allows people in the market to come back to us with their views in terms of the analysis that we're doing behind it.
And what does the one notch leeway refer to? What's the one notch?
The question here is how to implement the increase to the correlations, whether we basically say that going forward we're just going to multiply it by some factor, say 2 times, or whether in the process of implementing the change, and right now we're still testing. I mean, this is not we're final, this is the methodology, this is what we're doing. We're still doing the analysis, here are some earlier results that we're finding, and this is what we're thinking about doing. We could provide guidance to our rating analysts as well as the market about using a higher multiple instead of 2 times, the 2.5 times, for example, but using it as a stress test for a transaction. So what Eric is suggesting here is that if we think that we may end up with 2 times and we're not sure right now, that maybe we can tell the market for now that we're going to use the 2.5, but give them a one-notch leeway in terms of the rate. So if we think that a 2.5 multiple results in a one-notch downgrade, so basically what is the sensitivity to this increased stress? If it results in a one-notch downgrade, we would be okay with the rating as is. But if it results in a two-notch downgrade, then that's not something that we could live with.
All things being equal, mm-hmm. the greater the time, the mm-hmm. greater the multiple, the greater the correlation, mm-hmm. all things being equal, does that mean the lower the rating?
The lower the rating if they do not... It's either if you wanted a specific rating, you needed more credit enhancement, or given existing credit enhancement, you would get a lower rating.
Yeah, but all things equal, the more correlation, the lower the rating. If two deals are identical, and one's at 2, and one's at 1 mm-hmm. on the correlation, the all things equal, mm-hmm. no changes, mm-hmm. all things equal. The 2 times mm-hmm. would have a lower rating than the 1 time, correct?
Depends on what part of the capital structure you're in. Higher correlation tends to have a negative impact on the higher tranches.
Okay.
Higher correlation tends to have a positive impact on the lower tranches.
The AAA tranches.
The AAA tranches.
But the AAA tranches mm-hmm. would have a lower rating, all things equal, mm-hmm. if there's 2 times on the correlation versus the 1 time on the correlation, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And Mr. Kolchinski in his email says, is advocating doing 2.5 times with one notch, meaning you could take one off there, you give some leeway to it, or to go 2 times, and then he says without making any leeway. Is that
we could do either one.
Okay. And you say we need to find a way of positioning the one notch as our way of grandfathering. Why do you use the phrase we need to find a way mm-hmm. of positioning the one notch as our way of grandfathering?
I'm saying that if we go with his suggestion, that essentially we would be telling the market that when we go from the 2.5, this one notch difference, to let's say the 2 times, that the reason why we were doing it was because we were still testing to understand where we could come out to, but that's why we gave that one notch leeway, but that was our way of kind of getting to the final answer, the 2.5. So it was our way of kind of implementing this in a way that didn't disrupt the market too much, because we weren't too far away from what the end result would be. So 2.5 with one notch versus two times with no notch. There may not be a rating impact, but we want to explain why we were using 2.5 earlier, but then now we're using two times.
Do you recall what you settled on?
Excuse me?
Do you recall what you settled on?
I do not.
I have a couple wrap-ups here. I know I said this a second ago, but I do truly plan to wrap up here.
I told her not to believe you when you said that anyway.
It's a long wrap-up. You said something that caught my attention in your PSI testimony. First of all, did you write your testimony?
I did not write my testimony.
Who wrote it?
I believe it was written by Farisa Zarin, who is not even sure what her title is within the company. But she wrote it, and then I reviewed the sections that have to do with CDOs to make sure that it basically comported with my understanding.
Is she in public relations?
No, she's in regulatory affairs.
Okay. There's a phrase in there, reasoned, independent, and forward-looking. You said our ratings mm-hmm. were reasoned, independent, and forward-looking. Mm-hmm. Was that a phrase you came up with, or did she?
It was a phrase that was already in there, but it's one that I agree with.
You didn't initially write that phrase. She wrote the phrase.
Yes.
Okay. And is that what you believe ended up being the result, that your ratings were reasoned, independent, and forward-looking?
Yes, I do.
I've asked this question before, so your lawyers may have heard this question before, but let me ask you this. In anything that you or the persons working for you were doing with respect to the ratings of CDOs, synthetic, cash, or otherwise, do you feel like you made any mistakes leading up to the crisis or during the financial crisis?
I think that there have been a lot of lessons that we've learned from the crisis. And there have been changes that we've made. However, I don't think that I wouldn't say that we made a mistake. I'm certainly not happy about the outcome of the ratings. The ratings, as they were meant to predict the future outcome of the credit of these assets, did not turn out to be predictive. I feel that the process that we used to get to those ratings, however, was the appropriate process. I think what we missed is essentially underestimating the magnitude of the deterioration in the housing market. We missed the speed with which it occurred. We also missed the liquidity implications afterwards. However, I don't believe that it's due to a mistake that we made. I believe that based upon the information that we had, we made the best possible, we came up with the best possible opinion at that time as we do currently. I mentioned that there are lessons that we've learned. I mean, obviously, if we had 2020 vision, in terms of if I knew what I know today as to what the outcome could be, would I have wanted to use those, use what I know now in the analysis then? definitely, but it wasn't information that we had at that time. I think, you know, some of the lessons that we've learned, as I mentioned, is that part of it is really, for me, that one of the biggest things is really the transparency by us as well as the rest of the market. I think that there was a lot of misunderstanding about what the ratings were, what the meanings of it were, how it was used. I think there was a lot of misunderstanding about the way in which we arrived at ratings. And I think one of the things that we've tried to do since then is be even more open about each transaction that we rate, about the methodologies that we do. We are much more vocal and more precise in the press releases that we write and the information that we provide to the market, so that they have as much information as possible to come up with their own opinion based upon the assumptions that we've made. We've created something called assumption volatility scores. Actually, I don't know what the end name of that is, volatility scores or V-scores, that really talk about, here are the assumptions that we make when we rate a transaction. So not just the methodology, but here are the underlying assumptions, the parameters. But also, if here's our view with regard to those assumptions in terms of what is the data history behind the assumptions that we make, what is the source of the information, what is our view in terms of the certainty we have behind those assumptions. And part of the discussion that we have in committee, as well as what we do in terms of written research that we put out, is to talk about what our view is in terms of the certainty behind those assumptions and how we account for any uncertainty that we may have around those, as well as providing parameter sensitivities to the market in terms of what happens if those parameters happen to be off or the assumptions that we made happen to be off. So I think it provides a lot more information to the market to be able to look at our opinion, understand the basis for that opinion, and if they choose to disagree, not just with the rating and the opinion, they have the ability to see what was behind that as well.
And speaking of seeing what was behind things, mm-hmm. I understand that in the rating process of CDOs, folks working under you didn't have the ability to look at loan-level data. In other words, to look beyond the RMBS. Is that the case?
Well, a couple of things. The vast majority of deals that we rate are managed. So for those transactions, we're not looking at the RMBS themselves. We're looking at the covenants of the deal and what they're allowed to do. On a surveillance basis, we look at both. We look at both the covenants as well as the performance relative to the covenants and what the portfolio looks like at any particular point in time, knowing that could change.
Did you look at loan-level information, though, of the RMBS that served as the collateral on CDOs that you rated?
I guess what I'm trying to say is for the managed transaction, the information that were being provided on any specific day as to what even the RMBS looks like in that transaction could change from day to day. Mm-hmm. So the analysis is not focused on the collateral that's in the transaction, the specific names that are in the transaction, as much as it is focused on the performance relative to the covenants within the transaction, which is what we use to rate those transactions. Mm-hmm. For static transactions, we are typically given the RMBS. For those, you're right, we don't have the information behind the RMBS to look through to the individual mortgages. That analysis, even if we had that information, is not something that we would use necessarily to second-guess the analysis of the RMBS analysts who are looking at that information. So we are relying within Moody's on the Moody's view on the RMBS that's provided by the RMBS analysts.
Okay.
We do have that information.
Did you meet with your lawyers before you came in for your interview today?
With mm-hmm. them, yes.
And how long did you meet with
them? I mean, I don't think it is an appropriate question to ask someone how long they met with their lawyers. It's infringing on a attorney-client privilege aspect.
Not asking about anything you talked about. How long did you meet with your lawyers?
I'm going to stick with my objection.
You can answer.
I'm going to instruct the witness not to answer.
You're going to instruct the witness not to answer how long she met with her lawyers?
Yeah, I don't think that it's an appropriate question.
What's the basis for the objection?
Let's take a second here.
Sure.
Thanks.
Ask you a question.
Okay. How long did you meet with the lawyers in preparation for your interview today?
I came in this morning at 8:30. We had a couple hours of discussion. And yesterday, came in around 1:30 and was here until about 6:30.
Okay. Any other times?
For this interview.
Okay. Did you talk to him on the phone as well outside of those meetings about this interview?
No.
And were you shown documents by your lawyers during the preparation? Last question. Is there any question you expected to get today that you weren't asked?
I can't think of anything specific.
What about generally?
No.
When anyone ever says, I can't think of anything specifically, it always prompts the next question of generally. So, well, Mr. Yoshizawa, I appreciate your time today. Thank you. This process is confidential, so we ask that you don't discuss what we talked about today with anyone outside of your lawyers. Mm-hmm. Do you have any questions for me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you for your time. We're going off record, and it is concluding for the day at 6:51 p.m.